Committee on Human Services will come to order. It is Wednesday, September 20th. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for making time to come through the rain for day three of legislative days. We've got a pretty full agenda today. I think Senator Olson suggested it's maybe 9 hours worth of presentations and 2.5 hours, but I believe in us. We can get it done. So we are going to start with an opening of the organizational meeting and the adoption of committee rules. Oliver.
Great. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, there are a few changes that I'll just note quickly on the rules. They're organized a little differently in past years with added headings and some reordering and rewording. I'd say the two substantive changes this year that you'll see is there's an added provision on subcommittees, which is taken from the session rules and requiring submission of rule amendments to the Secretary of State in addition to committee members, which is required in session rules. So I think generally they're trying to line up both the House and Senate rules as much as possible in leadership offices.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Olson, would you please make the motion?
Madam Chair, I move we adopt the committee rules as read.
Senator Olson moves adoption of the committee rules. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And we'll close the organizational meeting. We should probably do quick introductions since we have new folks at our table. Corey?
Corey Rosenberg,
committee assistant. Lori Monis-Anderson, state senator from District 25. That's East Multnomah County, Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview.
Oliver Droppers, legislative analyst.
Sarah Gelser, Senate District 8, Corvallis, Albany, Philomath, and the surrounding areas.
Alan Olson, Senate District 20, the heart of Clackamas County.
Michael Dembro, Senate District 23, that's Northeast and Southeast Portland, Park Rose, and the lovely city within a city of Maywood Park.
Tim Canope, Senate District 27, includes Central Oregon cities of Bend, Redmond, and towns of Tumlo and Sun River.
And welcome, Oliver. We only talk about happy things here, so.
Great. Thank you.
All right. So we will open our first informational meeting, which is the DHS leadership introductions and our wonderfully newly confirmed director. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, Fair Boards Paxoresht, Director of Department of Human Services. I feel like I'm repeating myself, though this was in front of the House Human Services yesterday. Luckily, none of you were there, so you didn't hear all this stuff that I'm going to repeat. So just briefly, and I think some of you know that I've worked for the state of Oregon for the past 27 and a half years in a variety of roles in departments of administrative services, human services, and then for the past nearly 9 years in Oregon Youth Authority from 2008 to 2012 as the deputy director, and from 2012 through the end of last month as the director. There's a whole lot that has happened in DHS since I've been gone. I'm just within the last 13 working days. I've been meeting folks, some old faces, some new faces, getting to relearn the programs. I do want to take a moment and express my gratitude to Director Clyde Psyche, who has really helped me. You know, Clyde's been a good friend, a colleague, my former boss, a mentor, has played many roles in the state, but he's been instrumental in transitioning me back into DHS. My early observations as I'm meeting people and getting to learn about the agency is that we have many caring and dedicated people who are waiting to step up and contribute when they're asked. The environment is ripe for progress, and the agency has the right mission, vision, and values, and a lot of good work is happening in various parts of the agency. My priorities naturally is, you know, as you know, Senator Gelser, child welfare has been in the spotlight and a lot of focus on it. Again, a lot of work has happened over the course of the past 18 months, and that work I will commit to continue, as well as to pay attention to other areas of the agency. We are one of the few agencies that touch the entire continuum of life from pre-birth to transition. And many of our services connect to one another. So one of the challenges is how do we actually operate as one truly integrated agency? Consolidation is bringing things together. Integration is really working in a fashion that we are connecting on many different fronts. And we are already doing that, but I think we can do better. Another thing that I think some of you know from the work that we had done in Oregon Youth Authority was extensive work in using research, data, and analytics. That will naturally continue in OYA, but I will bring that knowledge and some of those practices into DHS. Some of that work is already occurring, but we'll, again, strengthen that with better use of data that could inform decision-making. Another priority would be strengthening the agency's performance management system, clearly defining the work, how that work gets done, who's responsible and accountable for it, and if we do that work well, what will it result in? What is the outcome? So that work will be happening, again, over the course of the next 6 to 8 months. And last but not least, strengthening equity and inclusion, which I think is important to many of you. So what I do want to say is I think, Senator Chair Gelser, you wanted me to talk about the new child welfare leadership, the director that we've just hired. So, and I think you know this, just for the members of the committee, what we did is after our former director resigned, which has been now about, I believe, 4 months, we started working with Casey Family Foundation and looking across the nation for some talent that we could perhaps bring in, and we identified about 15 individuals nationwide, and we narrowed that list to 3. One of those was an internal candidate, Marilyn Jones, who has been our district manager, actually has worked for the agency since 1998, but most recently, within the past 10 years, has been the district manager in Baker Union and Wallowa counties in eastern Oregon. She has personal and professional commitment to this work. She has experienced the agency from various perspectives. She started as a volunteer. She ultimately managed 11 foster kids and adopted 2 of them. She, along with the other 2 candidates, ultimately she rose to the top. And one of the major decision points was also, as you all know, when we bring folks from outside the state, it takes a good 6 to 8 months to integrate them into the environment, into the culture, into the agency. And that knowledge was already resident here. So we announced that decision last week, and Marilyn starts on October 9th. And again, Senator Gelser, thank you for calling on your vacation to speak with her. I do want to take a moment and express my appreciation to Lori Price for stepping in and filling this pretty important role. During this interim, there's a whole lot happening in child welfare, as she will convey to you at least on one of the projects just in a few minutes, but that's no easy task to keep the organization going. Also wanted to take a moment to thank Clyde for his attention to child welfare over the course of the past 18 months, but specifically within the past 4 months where he's been embedded in that organization, in that part of the agency, and I think you all know that we've made significant progress on that front. So let me stop there, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, and thank you for being willing to step into the role. That it's certainly I don't think there's words to describe how difficult and all-encompassing that role is for that agency. Are there questions?
I have one.
Senator Olson.
When I first got on this committee is when Mr. Saki came on to DHS, and one of the things I noticed was the I don't want to use the word difficulty, but I want to impress upon you how important it was to break the ceiling of continuity so that he could integrate his feelings into the agency. How do you plan to
get the staff, which is extremely large, to get on your train so that they can follow your lead?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olsen, that's a great question, and that's a leadership question. Naturally, the work in this organization will be a whole lot harder than it was in Oregon Youth Authority or any smaller organizations. But frankly, as we break this question down, I think from the leadership standpoint, if the vision is clear, if there is a clear direction, if a staff, and you know, we have five different organizations within DHS, and this is an umbrella organization, so clearly having the right people in the right places. You know, my philosophy has always been, if you're asking our staff to do something, we better give them the training, the tools, and the resources that they need to do the work. Identify exactly why we're doing that work and how it's going to get done. Identify how that work breaks down, and ultimately what's the outcome of that. This is an organization that helps people. This is an organization, some of our clients are with us because we are trying to get them back on their feet. Some of our consumers are with us through the end of their lives. And most people who work for this organization, and I met many of them, are working here because they care about this work, because they're passionate about the work. So if we can connect the mission of the organization, and if everyone can find themselves as to how they're contributing to that mission and the vision, and there's a process through which we do that, and that's really part of the performance management system that we're talking about. Your question also gets to the question of culture, and we talk about culture quite often. And again, when we talk about culture change, it's an incremental process. It's not going to happen overnight. It will take time. But first and foremost, it's my responsibility to practice and model the core values of the organization. If you're talking about transparency and openness, first and foremost, I need to express that. And then I need to express and actually follow this chain of accountability all through the organization. The larger the organization is, those points of connections become more important. You know, the more layers that are in the organization, how that message gets from the leadership of the organization to the people who do the work can become a bit compromised. Having said that, I also know fairly well that the people who do the work are the people who work in the front lines. So connecting with them, making sure that we're listening to them and taking care of the resource issues that they have, holding ourselves accountable and holding them accountable, and ultimately it's about people. That's a long answer to your question, but I and again, this work is not something that I can do by myself. It's our entire leadership team and our managers who will do that. And I hope that you will, and I know that you'll hold us accountable. And to the extent that, you know, you want to contact me anytime and see how we're making progress on that front, please do that, because that work is going to start immediately.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. We look forward to hearing from you more.
Thanks.
And I guess you can stay at the table. Our next is Child Welfare Contracting Accountability. We've got Lori Price and Morris. I realized that what I forgot to send to you was the report that this is about for OLIS. Can we add that into OLIS later? Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you. Good morning, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lori Price, and for the next handful or so of days, I'm the interim Child Welfare Director. And I've been asked today by this committee to come and report specifically on how we've been managing our contracts related to strengthening, preserving, and reunifying families. Not knowing how many of you have the history of that, the first couple slides are going to speak to how this work came about. So strengthening, preserving, reunifying families began in 2011 with Senate Bill 964. 964 was signed into law, and it provided additional resources, but it also required child welfare to provide extensive services to families throughout the life of a case. The objectives of, we call it SPERF, So I'll refer to it as SPRF in this presentation, but again, that's strengthening, preserving, reunifying families, is to reduce trauma by maintaining children safely in their own homes whenever possible, reducing the lengths of stay in foster care for those children that do have to enter out-of-home placement due to safety needs, and to reduce the reabuse rate and improve permanency outcomes for those that do enter our system. The Legislative Assembly made several findings regarding best practice when we moved forward with this work, and that was that severe trauma may occur when children are removed from their families, resulting in negative future outcomes. It's not a surprise to anyone. Improving permanency outcomes for children is most likely achieved when services are offered that allow children to stay home with their families, and that keeping families intact while services are provided preserves parent and child bonds and improves outcomes for children and families in the long term. They also noted that housing is essential to the safe reduction of the number of children in foster care. The history, once SPRF was signed into law, is that in 2011, as I mentioned, that legislation passed. In 2012, the agency selected three counties that piloted the SPRF contracts. And we'll talk a lot about how those came about. In 2013, it was expanded to four more counties. In 2014, all 36 counties in the state had some form of additional services funded by the SPRF funding to help support children and families in those communities. In 2015, the SPRF contracts had outcome-based language embedded in them, which was not there prior. And we began collecting baseline data to help us know what was working and what wasn't in each community throughout the state. And from 2016 to present, we've been reassessing our service gaps. We've been improving our contract administration of these contracts. And we've been evaluating our existing contracted providers for renewal of those contracts as they expire. Our district offices receive ongoing training, support, and consultation from our central office staff to continuously improve our contract administration and maintain consistency, as staff turnover also impacts our ability to manage contracts across the state. DHS reviews reports regularly with providers to look at trends and outcomes and identify where changes need to occur in the contract. This next map is a little busy, but what it's intended to show, and the symbols are off to the left along with a descriptor of what the symbol means in terms of services in each community. So that's a map of the state of Oregon. It shows all 36 counties. It shows that at least one service funded by SPRF dollars is available in each community. And as you can see, in our more urban or more highly populated areas, we have a variety of services available that are funded through the Strengthening, Preserving, Reunifying Families funding. I mentioned that I would talk to you about how these services came about. Initially, counties held specific meetings to identify gaps in service provision in their specific county. So they gathered a variety of community partners together and DHS staff together, looked at what was currently available in their communities, and that looked at where their gaps were. Where were we seeing families falling through the cracks? And that was where they determined that they were going to write services or write contracts for services to fill those gaps in their individual counties. So these are not services that were determined at the central office, but rather services determined in each individual community by the community themselves, where they felt like they could make a difference for families.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Olson.
If I may interrupt
and
ask about the map.
Sure.
Is it funding the reason why every county doesn't have every service?
Yes. Yes, Chair Olson, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson.
That's fine.
Yes, that's absolutely true.
We're okay with that.
That's absolutely true. It is based on funding. Funding was determined based on population, as many of our funding services are. There's a variety of calculations that we use for funding, but for SPRF specifically, we looked at how many families we were serving in each community and allocated the dollars associated with that.
Follow-up question. Hello. So since you said that, does that indicate that one of the lower north or southeast counties has better
family structure than, say, Astoria or Lincoln County? Or
it says that in Malheur County, we serve more families than we do in Astoria. So they received a broader pool to use, but they could also have smaller contracts. They could have indicated that within their own community that four smaller contracts would work better than one larger contract. Okay. So maybe they needed four services. They felt like they could fill a lot of little gaps versus saying, we're going to go all in on this one service and hope that it meets the needs of the families in our community. So, again, each of those were based solely by the community for the community.
One final follow-up.
Yeah, follow-up.
Have you ever estimated the financial need to put all the services in all the counties?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, no, we have not looked at what it would cost to fill every gap need within the state.
Would, follow-up, would that be something down the road you might take a look at?
Chair Olson, or Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, it would be our pleasure to take a look at what that would cost and provide that information to the committee, with knowing that that's our best guess, that these services are going to be these services that meet that gap for families and communities, and we would look at how many families we're serving in that community, what the cost of that service would be, and provide that information. Yes.
Thank you.
Senator, absolutely.
Thanks. Just following up on Senator Olson's questions. As I look at the map, in those areas that just have one or maybe two icons, the one that we're looking at, is that the Navigator, or what do those have? It's hard for
sure.
me to see.
Senator Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Dembro, the symbols themselves, so the square, the dark blue square, indicates Navigator services. Mm. The one that looks like a house right below it is parenting services to reinforce parenting behaviors and supportive yeah. services. The octagon is relief nursery. The upside down triangle, alcohol and drug treatment services. The looks like a bomb, front end interventions. The star is housing, and the circle is trauma services and therapeutic services. Now, these are services that supplement existing services within the community, funded through OHA, funded through counties, funded through philanthropic agencies. It's something that the communities identified as a gap that wasn't filled by any other resource.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so just to follow up, so I guess what I'm asking is, for those that just have one or maybe two, is it the Navigator that's the most common one? And is their job to link individuals to services maybe in other counties or statewide kinds of things? I'm just wondering how that's working.
Yes, Senator Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Dembro. Yes, the Navigator is the most popular service. It's one that we've proven to be effective through many grant opportunities and through 40 waivers in the past, where Navigators help families navigate all social service systems. So we help connect, those Navigators help connect with self-sufficiency programs like TANF and food stamps. They help connect with housing programs. They help connect the family many times with other services that you see on the map here, like alcohol and drug services or mental health services. They're a supportive person that walks that family through their experience with the agency.
I think it's a great concept. How well would you say it's working?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Dembro, the Navigator service is one, again, that we've proven to be effective. So we know it works. Now, whether it's the end-all, be-all in a specific county, that would be determined based on that specific county, how well that service works and to what degree they need that service and to what degree they need the other services supplemented that couple that. The Navigator can work very well on their own in connecting families with services that currently exist, but in many areas we have other service gaps, and the Navigator then fits nicely with other contracted services through our own agency as well to help support families.
We're going to address some of that in the upcoming slides. We should probably move on just to stay on.
But I have one question before we get up.
Of course you do.
Thank you. Why doesn't every county have at least a Navigator? You have some out there with just the bomb, the front end intervention.
I'm sorry. I couldn't think of a better way to explain it.
Yeah. So why wouldn't every county have at minimum the Navigator?
Mm-hmm. So, Senator Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, that in that community, they assumed that something else would work better. For that community, they thought front-end services were a gap and felt maybe that their workers could fulfill that role of connecting, because because it is a goal of our social service specialists, our caseworkers, to also make those connections. It just has worked better with a navigator to help actually walk the family to and from. And oftentimes our caseworkers, due to staffing levels and workload, don't have the time to have that real connection and be able to walk families through that experience like a navigator would. But again, that was an individual community decision, not one that we made as a state, that we said, with our SPRF money, everybody gets a navigator. We ask communities, what do you need? And that's what they determined they needed.
Some of these will come up in the afternoon slides.
It's a great map, though.
Mm-hmm. Also, great. We should all make sure that we know how to identify without names on the Oregon map, all 36 Oregon counties. Lori right. knows how to do that.
So I can do that now.
You can teach all of us.
I couldn't do it when I came here. I can do it now. The impact of strengthening, preserving, reunifying families. 43% of children statewide with child welfare involvement have received one or more services that have been funded by SPRF funding. The average age of a child receiving that first service is 5 years old, and the average age of a child served statewide by a contract funded through this through SPRF is 7 years old. The gender breakdown is about equal, 52% male, 48% female, as far as, and remembering that these contracts serve not just children, but children and their families. So many times it's the parents that are receiving the service. So the gender breakdown includes both. Talking quickly about why children are in foster care, due to the complex needs of our families, SPRF alone cannot alleviate or address all of the stress factors that families are facing. This is not an exclusive list, and it also would indicate, you can see there's way more than 100% here. So many of our families that present with alcohol and drug issues may also have a domestic violence issue in their home, may also have mental illness, parental mental illness, may also have inadequate housing. But these are the primary reasons that families get our attention to begin with. The under 3%, where it says others, includes a child with developmental disabilities that are unable to be managed in their family home that come to our agency, a heavy child care responsibility that a parent can't manage because they're working one, two, three jobs and they kind of give up, and a parent with a developmental disability that is having trouble managing their child without additional supports that aren't available elsewhere. And the breakdown of that, I can do that real quick, 2.8% on the child developmental disability, 2.1% on the heavy child care, and 2.1% on parents with developmental disabilities.
So, and I just wanted to point out, we had this conversation yesterday in Ways and Means, I think as a policy question, when we look at reducing the number of children in foster care, to see that 11% plus, I didn't realize more of those 3% are because we are unable to provide appropriate supports to families to support their children at home that they want to have at home, that they otherwise could safely care for at home. A lot of times it's kind of what Mr. Pechtret talked about earlier. It's not just consolidation of these services together. They all impact each other pretty significantly. And I hope that's something as a legislature we can look at in terms of funding priorities if we aren't supporting families to stay together in the face of physical disability, developmental disability, or, you know, the big conversation we've had, access to child and adolescent mental health, that is directly impacting our overfull child welfare agency by pushing those kids into foster care when abuse and neglect isn't actually the issue.
Thank you, Senator. And it's an important point to know that many of our families, we introduce ourselves to them, but there are a number of families that come to us and ask for our help and voluntarily sign their children to child welfare because they can't get the services or they can't manage the behaviors of their child on their own.
Senator Gailston? Let's do Senator Monson first.
You might have said it, but I missed it. How many children are in foster care?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Monis Anderson, on any given day, we have just over 7,600 children in the foster care system here in Oregon.
And again, if you take that to the 11%, you're looking at close to 800 kids that are in foster care that don't actually need to be in foster care. We are placing them there because we're not supporting families with appropriate mental health and developmental disability services. Oh, and Senator Olson, I'm sorry.
Thank you. On your top one where you have alcohol and drug issues, this is of concern to me. Since we have legalized marijuana, have you seen any uptick in in cases caused by specific use of marijuana? Or are you tracking it?
Chair Olson, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson.
It all works.
Yeah. I am so sorry. I need to get back to you on that one. I am certain we're tracking it. I don't have that number on the top of my head.
Very nice picture of you, too.
What I can tell you is that we have implemented or broadened our alcohol and drug or alcohol policies to include marijuana. So the fact that it has to be keeping safe, locked up, away from children, you can't be under undue influence and caring for your child. Those same rules apply, but we'll take a look at that and see what we can get for you.
It doesn't have to be immediate. It can be way down the road if you want.
Thank you. This slide just displays its interdependent system. SPERF services alone, again, are not the only factors supporting family preservation, reunification, or family change in our system. And just this illustrates the number of partners that can wrap around a family. And just for your information, 70% of our clients are also on Medicaid. 70% of our clients also are receiving some form of service through self-sufficiency, whether it's SNAP, our food stamps program, or TANF, or jobs work. 30% of our families are working with the housing department. 10% of our families have IDD issues. 15% of our families actually receive services through our APD, our Adults and Persons with Disabilities category. 10% are engaged with vocational rehabilitation, and 15% have involvement with Department of Corrections.
And one other question for information to come back later, and I don't know if this is a question for you or for Lilia, but that number of kids that are in foster care related to a disability, I'm assuming that's the number that is in child welfare alone and doesn't count the couple hundred kids that are in DD foster care, also voluntarily placed, but through the DD system.
Senator Gelser, that's correct. We have a number of shared children where child welfare has custody, and they're also DD eligible, and we call those our shared children. And there are children that are just in the DD system that don't have child welfare involvement.
And can you get back to us the total number of kids that are in care, either in and maybe break it out, either through child welfare or through developmental disabilities that are there solely because of their developmental disability, their physical disability, their medical need, or their mental health need, where the family kind of voluntarily said, I can't do this because I don't have the supports.
Yes.
Thank you.
Happy to. I want to talk a little bit about our contract management. So we do biannually review needs and gaps in each community. And when I say we, it's the collective we. That's done at the local community level. They revisit what's working. It becomes a bit of a challenge because if you believe you've filled a gap with a contract and now you've identified another gap, it's a struggle to determine, do you switch that funding to another contract or do you stay invested in the one you've got? But we depend on the counties and their communities to make those decisions. Again, the districts revisit that on a biannual basis, and they take into account the data along with the performance of their existing contracted providers. Districts also consult with each other to see what's working in other areas, to see if maybe they've missed something, and they can talk a little bit more about best practices and what works. And in the instance where a provider has a low percentage of outcome achievement, we're going to talk a little bit more about that in just a couple of slides. The local offices engage in discussions with those providers about how to bring those numbers up and to identify if there is a concern of the quality of service or whether DHS has made an error, maybe, in what service they've assigned that family to, and maybe we need to add additional supports around that family. Contract outcomes. So this is how we're currently measuring them. And Director Pak Suresh about, I think, fell out of his chair when he saw that this is as good as we do. We've got a definite room for improvement here. But how we're currently measuring these contracts is through achieved, partially achieved, or not achieved. And this slide illustrates what that means in different areas. So the navigator, we were talking a little bit about navigator. What does it mean when a navigator service is achieved under the outcomes-based contract? That means that the client accessed all necessary available resources and services that were assigned or identified by the worker and the family when they engaged in navigator services. Partially achieved means the client accessed one or more of the necessary available resources and services, and not achieved means the client didn't access any. Long-term housing is a little bit more black and white. The client transition to the agency-approved living situation is achieved. There is no partially achieved. Not achieved would mean they did not transition into the living situation. And then a parent education and coach, one-on-one coach for parents. Achieved, again, would mean the client met all agreed-upon service goals. Partially achieved means they met one or more. And not achieved means the client did not meet any of those service goals that were agreed upon between the worker and the family. One thing that we've agreed to do right off the top is to take a look at that partially achieved and look at a percentage versus a yes or no. Did they partially achieve those services? It's something that we should be able to do rather easily moving forward. In form of a pie chart, this is what it looks like for the services that have been funded through the Strengthening, Preserving, Reunifying Families funding. 67% of the contracts goals were achieved. That means the client met every goal that was outlined between themselves and their caseworker when they were referred to a service. 14% were partially achieved, and that's an area where we can flush that out more moving forward about whether that means that they just met one or more of those goals. Right now it means they met one or more, and that can have a varying impact on the parent's ability to safely parent their child. And then 19% were not achieved. And that's the group where our communities are working with providers to find out, did we refer the family to the wrong service, or is the service provider not adequately providing the service that we've contracted with them to provide? This breaks it down just a little bit further. Where we can
follow up on the not achieved.
Of course.
So you, do you have staff to actually work one-on-one on individual cases where the gray, you know, they did not achieve their goals, or, you know, what kind of follow-up? Because I know you're woefully underfunded and staff is overworked, but we don't want to be having money go down an open hole, so...
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Mona Sanderson, I appreciate the question. It is the caseworker's responsibility as they work with the family toward reunification, and then if that no longer is an option, toward permanence, other forms of permanency for that child. It is the caseworker that's connecting one-on-one with that family about what's not working. They won't be the person negotiating with the provider. They have folks in the branch, and it varies by branch about who that person is. Sometimes it is our program manager or district manager that's managing and negotiating these contracts. Sometimes they've carved out part of a business position that manages and works with these contracts, but ultimately it's the caseworker's responsibility to make sure that we're matching the right service with the family to expedite reunification of their child.
And just follow, and will they have the opportunity, or do they have the opportunity to state why it didn't work and what could be changed to make it work?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Mona Sanderson, yes, the family does and the caseworker does.
Thank you. And one question on the, and we talked about this a little bit in the office and I've thought about it more, the mental health therapy piece. How, I guess two questions related to that. How do you determine, without breaking client confidentiality from a branch, whether an individual is meeting their therapeutic goals? And if you're observing kind of HIPAA rules around that, what's the accountability for the provider? If you can't see the records, and I don't think you should be able to, of what the therapeutic goal process is that entirely reliant on the contractor to say, yes, this person is meeting the goals, and you just kind of go with that?
Chair Gelser, many times clients sign waivers, especially with services funded by the department for administrative purposes. And many of these types of services, as with our administrative medical services, where we're asking folks to engage in things, we can talk high level with providers about what's working and what's not working with the family. We should be able to have a conversation with them about, do you think this is the right service? Are there other services we should be providing to this family? Is there something additional that we can be doing to support this parent through this process to assure reunification of their child? We don't get specifically into the mental health, the clinical aspect of the mental health work, but at a high level we can talk about, is there something that we're missing?
And I guess that's the question, because the description of
how it's determined was the meeting, you know, one or more therapeutic goals, and it seems like therapeutic goals are clinical. I mean, that's a piece of clinical information that's not a high level, how is the family doing?
Chair Gelser, I absolutely agree with you. And I can go back and take additional look. We got some more data from our data person, but it really didn't answer that specific question. So I'll have to go back and look at the individual contracts in each community. We have boilerplate language, but I'm interested to see how those mental health contracts are written to see exactly how we're making that connection for families. And I'd be happy to report back to the committee.
That would be great. And just to clarify, the question is that conflict between, we shouldn't violate the confidentiality between an individual and their therapist for any reason ever. At the same time, if the accountability is based on the client rather than the contractor, how are you holding that contractor accountable? And I think that's the question that I have about all the contracts, and we talked about that, and I know data is going to get better, but you know, what families do is one thing, but you know, how do we know that we're hiring the best contractors that are being good stewards not just of public dollars but of these families that are at a very vulnerable time? Their time is probably even more valuable. That time in their life to meet their goals is probably more valuable than even the dollars that we put into it.
Chair Gelser, that's a very fair question, and we'll see what we can learn about that.
So as you keep working through the data, will you be disaggregating it so that these are pretty gross categories here. So if you were to look at them in terms of, say, demographics, regions, but also, was it a case of the client refusing the service or as opposed to funding being the reason? I mean, it would be good to see larger patterns within these very large categories of yes, no, maybe.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Dempro, I couldn't agree more. And we've got much work to do in that area, and we'll be doing that work.
And just one question back to the mental health. Mental health therapy is so complex, so individual, and some things may work with one child, others won't work, and I am most concerned in the competency of those giving the mental health therapy. We did try to get psychologists who are very well trained to be able to be more active, and then I heard that in the Medicaid program, many of those who are giving mental health therapy aren't even licensed. I'm not sure what kind of data you have regarding who is actually giving the mental health therapy.
And I think building on Senator Montes Anderson, thank you, because that really helps to get to the question around this. A while ago, Dr. Richardson and I visited a place, and they talked about doing DBT. But, Dr. Richardson is an expert in this area and quickly pointed out that nobody at this facility had the appropriate training to do it. They were providing it to a population that the program was not designed for, and they didn't have any of the materials, curriculum, or programming in order to do it. So if the accountability was based on did the individuals receiving that service meet their goals, that doesn't really get to was the provider that we're sending the money to competent to do that? Is it really about the individual meeting the goal, or are we hiring the right person to do the right thing for the right population?
I understand. Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Montes Anderson, I appreciate those questions. And what I would say is that at this very grossly high level that we're managing contracts now, that we would see that provider was not meeting outcomes over and over and over again. There would be an indication with a provider like that was unskilled. We should be looking at that. And as far as going back and looking at the contract specifically in mental health, but in all of our areas to see what the licensure is, we can do that now. And we will do that now.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Another part of the question was, where are they now? What happens to children and families once they receive a service that's funded by SPRF? And in the table to the left, it shows what the services were like before. And on the table to the right, it shows what services are like after.
And you can see the SPERF services are the darker line. And families that did not receive a SPERF service are the lighter line. And you can see that we've achieved some pretty good marks in both areas over the course of time. You can see that once SPERF services were received or not, more children were adopted, fewer children are in foster care, more children are served in home. Substitute care for purposes of this is our residential care, and there are fewer children in residential care and more children home. Certainly with SPERF services intact, more children are home on trial of reunification with their parents.
So if substitute care is residential care, and so family foster care is all foster care, that's not just foster care with a person to whom the child is related.
It's all foster care.
Okay.
Chair Gelser, it's all foster care. It could be a relative foster care provider. It could be, but they're all certified in the state of Oregon, whether they're relative foster care providers or general applicant foster care providers. They're certified foster care providers in the state of Oregon. They all receive a foster care payment, and they all are required to abide by the rules of the foster care system.
And then a question for Mr. Puxeret. I'm learning to say the name. I'm sorry I say it the wrong way. Is there just given your experience at OIA with the data, I mean, there's two really important comments on the bottom of this, that this is interesting information, but we don't really know that it means anything as it relates to SPERF services. Is there a way to gather data that actually gives us a sense of whether SPERF services are, I mean, these things happened, but they're not necessarily causal. How do we answer that question with data?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, what we're going to do is we're going to dig deep into the data. And I think all the questions that were asked are great questions. Some of the earlier questions were about, was the service received? And then how do you actually gauge the quality of the service? So the outcome measures that we'll develop will be based on that. And then again, one additional step would be, you brought up a scenario where a provider is basically telling us that they're providing a service that they don't have any competency in. So that will be looked at. But additionally, when we see that a provider is not successful, then the question comes back to us, are we matching the right youth with the right need with the right provider? That's a pretty important question, because we cannot blame providers who don't have competency in that particular area. So service matching becomes a pretty big part of the work that we're doing here. Why did this service work for this particular youth, but it didn't work for this other youth? And so it really is about individualizing data and getting away from the aggregate numbers. We already know that a particular service is helpful for some particular kids, but does it actually work for Johnny? And why it does and why it doesn't. So what we're going to be doing is, first of all, look at the integrity of the data. Then we're going to be digging deeper into what the data is actually telling us and getting some specific answers to the questions that you asked. And I'm sure we'll be talking with you about that.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, I think one other challenge, and one that we'll be looking at quite closely, will be how do we identify that it was the SPERF service and not the other services that a family was receiving, either through a partner agency or through a community, that really made the difference for that family. Be a little bit of a challenge as well. Just as an FYI to you, there was $8.9 million in the last biennium of general fund that was used to fund these SPERF contracts throughout the state, and about $4.5 million annually.
And because we're running behind, I'm going to ask people to read the last slides. That
absolutely.
But if there are things you want to highlight, please do that. I don't want to take that away from you.
Thank you, Senator. The last few slides really talk about what it means to families. It's feedback from families, feedback from providers, and feedback from our staff. And then, of course, if you have any questions, my contact information is on the rear slide. thank you for your time this morning.
And thank you. I know this was a lot of work, and that you put a lot of energy, and there are a lot of people back at the office that aren't here that are probably watching that put a lot of work into this. So thank you to you and your staff and everyone that gets ready for these legislative days that are a big workload issue for all of you. We appreciate it. In addition to all the other daily work that you have to do. Mm-hmm. All right. Our next piece is child welfare and parents with disabilities. This is an issue that most members of the committee contacted me about and wanted to discuss. We're going to have a bill on this in the February session. Senator Knope, did you want to say anything before we get started? All right. So the goal for today, we've got a whole variety of people to kind of hit this from a variety of perspectives. We aren't doing this in a way that's looking at a particular case. You're welcome to stay or sit, because I think Robin's going to present for a while, or Ms. Powell. So who we have on the phone to start with the presentation, there was a publication just a couple of years back from the National Council on Disability, which is a federal agency, about the rights of parents with disabilities and the experience in the states of both with custody when there's a divorce or whatever, and also with child welfare agencies. So the author of that report, Robin Powell, who used to work for the National Council on Disability and now is Brandeis, is going to talk through a little bit about what she found and some of the recommendations she had for the state. In OLIS, you'll be able to find both the report, which is called Rocking the Cradle, and an article that Ms. Powell wrote about a case specific to Oregon. After we hear from Ms. Powell, we'll hear from Lori Price and Lilia Tennenty. Again, it's this place where DHS entities come together. We also have here Bob Jundeff to talk about it from a rights perspective, and Lisa Shulman from the Pearl Buck Center that is doing some really good work around supporting parents with disabilities, and she'll be able to talk to us a little bit about the long-term outcome for non-disabled children of disabled parents and where they land after they've been parented by their parents. So that's the lay of the land. It's a lot to dive into. Want to be clear, it's not about a specific case, but about a pretty significant public policy issue that we're facing, not just in Oregon, but across the country. And with that, I will turn it over to Ms. Powell.
All right, thank you. And you can hear me, I assume?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, great. I just want to begin by thanking you for the opportunity to testify today. As Senator Gelser mentioned, I am formerly from the National Council on Disability, where I was an attorney advisor there for 5 years. And for those not familiar with the National Council on Disability, NCD is an independent federal agency that advises the President and Congress and all federal agencies on all matters affecting people with disabilities.
And Robin, for the record, you need to start with your name. I'm sorry.
Sorry. I'm Robin Powell.
thank you.
Sorry. And I am now a research associate at the National Research Center for Parents with Disabilities, which is at Brandeis University. And I'm still an attorney. I'm a PhD candidate as well. And research estimates indicate that there are at least 7 million parents with disabilities in the United States. I want to emphasize that this is likely grossly underestimated because there's just not great data collection on how many parents with disabilities exist. And these prevalence estimates include parents with a range of disabilities. So I'm discussing intellectual disabilities as well as physical disabilities, people who are blind or deaf, as well as parents who have psychiatric or mental health disabilities. What we do know is that parents with disabilities exist in large numbers, and that number is expected to continue to grow as more people with disabilities become more integrated into their communities. And so many people with disabilities are now expecting what so many of their non-disabled peers want, which is to have a family. Despite this large prevalence of parents with disabilities in the United States, we know that parents with disabilities continue to experience significant disparities and discrimination. As Senator Gelser mentioned, I was able to write the report, Rocking the Cradle, Ensuring the Rights of Parents with Disabilities and Their Children, which was released 5 years ago, September 27th, 2012, so it will turn 5 years old next week. And this report is really a groundbreaking compendium. It marks the first time that any federal agency had devoted significant resources to just looking at the issues related to parents with disabilities. The report is very lengthy. It includes over 1,000 citations as well as dozens of interviews with both parents with disabilities as well as experts who have worked in this field for decades. The report covers a variety of topics such as child welfare, family law, adoption and foster care, reproductive health, and then supports for families where a parent has a disability, as well as how to assess parents with disabilities to determine whether they are able to safely raise their children. As we noted in the report, Rocking the Cradle, parents with intellectual or psychiatric disabilities experience the most discrimination, and research has found that they experience removal rates as high as 80%, that is, child welfare agencies remove children from parents who have psychiatric or intellectual disabilities rates as high as 80%. This is a very disproportionate number. Estimates indicate that probably about 1% of parents in the United States have an intellectual disability, so you can see that it's very disproportionate. Parents with physical disabilities, as well as those who are blind or deaf, also experience significant discrimination. And this discrimination also carries out in lower reunification rates for parents with disabilities than those who do not have disabilities. In addition to revealing really the pervasive discrimination that exists, Rocking the Cradle set forth a number of recommendations, which includes model state legislation, which is aimed at ensuring the rights of parents with disabilities, while also ensuring that children remain safe. I think it's important to note that removals based on disability, including intellectual disabilities, are not grounded in science. The research actually suggests that disability in and of itself generally is not a predictor of one's parenting ability. Research has consistently found that a person's IQ does not predict whether they can care for a child unless the IQ is below 50, and that most problems that are found related to parents with disabilities and their children are not actually a result of the parent's disability, but rather the circumstances that they live in. So parents with disabilities tend to have higher rates of poverty and housing insecurity and domestic violence and things like that, and that is often what is attributed to the adverse outcomes, if at all. What we do know is keeping families together is good for children. Extensive research shows that children always fare better when they remain with their parents. Foster care, as we know, is very expensive for states, and that children raised in foster care often have worse outcomes, including lower employment rates, less insurance coverage, and higher rates of homelessness than the rest of the population. And despite all of this, children of parents with disabilities continue to be inappropriately removed from their homes or separated from their parents without any determination at all as to if at all the parent's disability has affected their parenting ability. Notably, disability alone should never be a reason to prohibit custody or parental rights, and reliance on a parent's disability without explanation is illegal. Indeed, according to the United States Department of Justice and the Department of Health and Human Services, a decision to terminate parental rights, remove custody, or deny parenting time to a parent based solely on the disability violates the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the Department of Justice actually was involved in a case in Massachusetts regarding a parent with an intellectual disability in 2015, where they found that the state violated the APA by not providing appropriate supports to the family. Recently, the American Bar Association passed a resolution supporting the requirement of a showing of causal relationship between a parent's disability and significant harm or imminent risk of harm to their child. So the APA is urging that states develop and implement legislation that would ensure the rights of parents with disability and include consideration of appropriate supports and services, reasonable modifications that can alleviate any harm or imminent risk of harm to the child. And there is really a national trend, particularly in the last 5 years since Rocking the Cradle was released. 14 states have passed legislation related to parents with disabilities and the child welfare and family law systems. Most of this legislation states that an actual harm needs to be demonstrated, and you can't just remove a child because the parent has a disability. An additional 7 states currently have legislation pending before their legislatures. And again, a lot of this legislation is based on the Rocking the Cradle model legislation. I just want to end by saying I hope I demonstrated today that I really believe that ensuring the safety of children as well as safeguarding the rights of parents with disabilities is really not mutually exclusive of one another. And again, thank you for the opportunity to provide this testimony today.
Thank you, Ms. Powell. And I realize I don't know about conflict of interest, but I served on the National Council of Disability at the time we released this, and Ms. Powell was a colleague of mine. Are there any questions for Ms. Powell? No? Thank you so very much. In Oregon, we have this OLA system where we can have all of these materials online. We have the Rocking the Cradle report in the OLA system, as well as the recent article that you wrote. And we may be in touch in the coming months. We'll be using one of our committee bills to have legislation on this topic moving forward.
Great. I look forward to hearing from you.
All right. Thanks. Nice to hear your voice.
Thanks.
Bye. All right. Next up... I'm wondering if we should bring Bob Junduff up first and then Laurie and Lillia. Does that work for everybody? All right. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Junduff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. And this is a topic that we've brought to you in the past. I just wanted to remind those who were around at the time and maybe alert some of you that in 2013, Disability Rights Oregon advocated for House Bill 3219, which was a bill that would address this very topic. And what I'd like to say about it is that it didn't move forward, and I have a few observations I'll just share with you. I don't have to go over the information that was already provided, but many of you may have heard of the term implicit bias, which is sort of an automatic assumption that we make about certain types of people. Our observations have been that this is an area that is significantly affected by implicit bias. I'll give you an example from just earlier this morning, is that in the CPS report to you, it was noted that 5.5% of children were removed because of, quote, parental mental illness. Now, there was, when you saw that, you may have thought, well, of course, I know what that means. That means that the parents' mental illness interfered with their ability to take care of the child. But in fact, the way it was presented implicitly suggested that if a person had a mental illness, that they would be unable to care for their child. In a society in which we know that 20% of our citizens have a mental illness of some level of severity, it's clear that that statement in and of itself is inaccurate.
And Bob, can I ask a question to clear? Because I don't think that was specifically stated. Is that because the way that the slide ran, it talked about the primary reason for removal, and that was a primary reason for removal that was listed separate from the abuse or neglect?
Senator Gelzer, that's correct. And I only pointed out as an example of how certain types of terminology or identities can automatically have additional assumptions. And this is an area that in which that occurs, and it affects very, very significant rights of people. And so that's why we brought our bill forward. The present law still contains the term mental retardation, and it specifically singles out emotional illness, mental illness, and mental retardation as things that heighten scrutiny of parents. And we believe that that's a problem in the law, and we're hoping that that can be corrected. And also in the legislation that we brought forward, just state plainly that that the mere existence of a disability does not disqualify a person from being a parent. So that's what we're hoping to work with you in the future to bring into Oregon law.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Tindall? And can you have the statute with you? I pulled up 3219, but what does the I mean, does our law currently actually say that in and of itself is a reason for removal, separate from any actual harm or imminent risk of harm to a child?
What the existing law says is that in determining conduct or conditions that are disqualifying, a condition being something that can be disqualifying, quote, emotional illness, or mental retardation of the parent of such nature and duration as to render the parent incapable of providing proper care for the child for extended periods of time. I think if read literally and specifically, sure, that makes sense. We wouldn't want anything that's going to interfere with a person's parenting ability that's going to endanger a child to be disqualifying. But the very fact that these are the things that are singled out is troubling.
Thank you. And I notice I've got it pulled up, kind of reading through. That is pulled out separately from the other items, which are conduct toward any child of an abusive, cruel, or sexual nature, addictive or habitual use of intoxicating liquors or controlled substance to the extent that parental ability has been substantially impaired, physical neglect of the child or ward. So it's separated out from actual impact to the child.
Correct, Senator Gilzer. So whereas the other sections talk about behaviors that endanger a child, this is the only section that highlights an identity. And that identity itself creates a heightened scrutiny, if you will, of a person's behavior.
And then finally, mental illness or intellectual or developmental disability, when it talks about a nature or duration, the nature and duration of those disabilities are permanent. It's not that you have an intellectual disability for 2 years and then your Down syndrome goes away.
Senator Gilzer, some disabilities are intermittent. So mental illness, for example, can be more severe and less severe. There's a document that I'll be referring to as we move ahead, which is from the U.S. Department of Justice and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, that talks about how the Americans with Disabilities Act applies to this area and how people in the construct of that law of disability discrimination, that some people need reasonable accommodations and supports in order to have the benefit of any service from the government. And in the child welfare area, that's particularly true, where a parent may need additional services and supports in order to succeed as a parent. What we would suggest is that those types of services should be built into our child welfare system in order to assure the child's safety and that the child would have the benefit of growing up with their own parents.
Thank you. And can you send that document to Oliver just so it's in the file under this hearing, making it easy for us all to refer back?
Be glad to do that.
And Senator Gilzer, this is a problem. Just last week, I mean, I hear from constituents all the time. Just last week, and I've already sent, I think, the email to THS of a deaf couple who had someone removed from their home, and now the case is closed, and they do not have their child. And it's very frustrating for them. And so I really do hope that we look at this.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, Lori Price and Lilia Tennany, please.
Good morning, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lilia Tennanty. I'm the director for the Office of Developmental Disability Services in DHS. I was invited this morning to talk about services that we provide through the DD system to parents with intellectual and developmental disabilities. In general, the DD program provides vital services to both adults and children with intellectual and developmental disabilities that include things like helping them with eating, dressing, engaging in their community, which could be learning how to access transportation, going to the grocery store, engaging socially with peers and with people without intellectual and developmental disabilities, and then ultimately as well, our big focus around helping people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, working with VR, get integrated jobs in the community. In general, most of our services fall under a terminology or category called ADL and IADL, which is supports to help people with activities of daily living or instrumental activities of daily living. At this point, I will say that we do not have any data on the number of parents that we provide service to, parents with intellectual and developmental disabilities, because that's not a category in our billing system, which is how we gather most of the information that we report to legislators and others statewide for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We do know anecdotally from discussions with our leadership team, with our field, with providers, that we absolutely do provide supports to parents with intellectual and developmental disabilities who have their children living with them in their homes. In the context of the types of services we provide, we are a Medicaid program, and what that means is that the service we provide needs to support the person who's identified as being eligible. In the context of our broader services, when we do that, if we have an adult who is also a parent with intellectual and developmental disabilities, in the situations that we're aware of, and we've even gotten involved in to some extent with our field, if the activities of parenting require the parent to have some supports from the DD system, that's part of what we provide to that parent. We try to work with them to ensure, to the extent possible, they can effectively support their child. I make that distinction because what, through Medicaid funding, we don't do and can't do is provide direct services to that child unless that child is also determined to be intellectually and development or developmentally disabled. So we provide the support to the parent who supports the child. We don't provide care directly to that child unless the child also meets our eligibility criteria of meeting an intellectual or having an intellectual or developmental disability. In general, in this topic, when we look at a situation of a parent, the philosophy of the DD system, supported broadly by our stakeholder community, is that we look at people from the perspective of what they can do and the supports that they need to achieve their goals. And obviously, for parents of children with intellectual and developmental disabilities, just like parents without intellectual and developmental disabilities, having goals specific to and relating to how well they care for their children and supporting their children in their home is something that's important to them and something that we want to support through our services. And I'm happy to answer any questions related to this.
Great, thanks. Any questions for...
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lori Price. I'm the Interim Director of Child Welfare Programs. And I just had a couple of comments that I wanted to share with the committee today. First of all, in Oregon's policy around safety of children, there is nothing that states that because somebody has an intellectual or developmental disability or an addiction issue or a mental health issue or a physical disability or any combination of the above, that that should be a reason for removing a child. Our decisions are always solely made, and the safety model dictates that they should be made based on the safety of the child. One thing I was thinking about as Lilia was talking, is we do have the ability to provide specific services to families. We talked about SPRF just a moment ago, but we have a couple of other flexible funding sources in a much, much, much smaller scale. One is called System of Care. One is called In-Home Safety and Reunification Services, where we could provide services to wrap around a child and family for a very short term. But once a case is closed through the child welfare system, we can't provide any paid services for that family any longer. So as you become aware or hear from your constituents that there are challenges or people are concerned that, as Senator Mona Sanderson just mentioned, there was a deaf couple, and I'm glad that you're inquiring about that. We'll take a look at that case. I know there was a case in Senator Canope's area that was very public, that we really want to take a deep dive into these cases internally to be sure that those implicit biases that were talked about by the first person testifying are not playing any sort of a role in decision-making around the removal of children from their families in Oregon.
When you're doing your cultural competency training, and this came up a little bit yesterday, is sensory disability, intellectual disability, mental health, is that included in cultural competency?
Senator Gelser, I don't believe they're specifically called out, and that's something that we need to look at.
I think one of the things, and I truly believe that there isn't a policy or a belief. I think we have talked about this in healthcare. We talk about it a lot in judiciary, in housing, this idea of implicit bias and how it changes the assumptions that right. people are making. I know in one of the cases in Oregon that became got some national attention, and I don't know how the national TV station got kind of DHS documents, but one of them described one of the parents as dirty, lazy, and retarded. I mean, is that, it seems like that would kind of go to that idea of implicit bias and cultural competency. Is, I guess that's why the question is around, you know, what that says about the perceptions of the parent. How could that be addressed absent a policy?
So, Chair Gelser, that one set me back a bit. That is something that we should be addressing directly with that staff person. That staff person shouldn't be working with families with that mindset.
But Senator Gelser, agencies. I mean, as a public health nurse, when I first started, and I grew up in a nice, loving family. All right, yes, my sister was deaf, but. Still, we were loving, we did things together, et cetera. And when I first started, and it was mainly Medicaid clients that I started visiting, home visiting, I was appalled. But as I got more experience, et cetera, I started learning that not everyone is like me. And I'm just worried that there are some case managers that maybe never get out of their silo of what they think is right and what is a giving and loving family. We can't all be a thing. And so that's my worry, that there are decisions being made by case managers that because of their own belief system or value system. So, and I don't know how to get beyond that, because with me it just came with experience and seeing that kids turn out great, you know, and don't have to be like my family was.
Senator Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Mona Sanderson, I so appreciate those comments. It's an area where we've had a challenge. We talked a little bit about this yesterday, but our workforce has changed over the last 10 years. When we implemented the requirement that all caseworkers have a bachelor's degree, the face of our workforce changed, where we started getting a lot of young folks straight out of college, and it worked well for a while. We had that mix of long-term folks in our system, long-term caseworkers in our system that had real depth of life experience, and we had new folks coming into our system that had a strong educational background, and they were an excellent mix. And as our as time has changed and we've lost that experience, and as we talked about yesterday with the high turnover of our staff in the child welfare system, we've lost a lot of that foundational work. And that's what you're talking about, Senator Mona Sanderson, is hard to teach in a classroom. But we're giving it our best shot, and we're pairing people up with our more experienced workers to help them gauge that a bit. Some of that learning happens through our Child and Family Services review process that is a federal review tool, but we encourage all workers to get out and really take a look at what we're managed and monitored on. But changing the way that people view what is okay is a tough thing, and we're addressing it every way that we can.
So in the cultural competency and the core training that's being redone, a lot of times in culturally responsive practice training or cultural competency training, people from different communities are brought in. I mean, would it be possible to consider in that training bringing in people that are autistic, people that are deaf, people that have an intellectual disability, to give people the opportunity to see the different ways that people move in vocal patterns, and what does stimming mean, and why is that not dangerous if I, you know, want to flap my hands? Is that
Chair Gelser, I think that's a very fair ask. One of the things that we have added into our core training through the redesign is simulation. And what you're describing would fit very nicely into a simulation exercise where we're engaging workers in what it would really be like to walk into a home. They've set up different rooms that are home-type settings. We've been addressing it more on the safety side for workers, because oftentimes we send them in where police officers don't even go alone. So talking to them about their own safety, but also stressing the family engagement component. And this, to me, is just an extension of that family engagement component, where it's how to engage all families. And I will absolutely take that back to our training arm and talk to them about the possibilities of embedding something like that into our core that's really clearly around these particular issues.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lori, obviously, we don't want to talk about necessarily specific cases, but I think it's really important that we, you know, if there's going to be these deep dives with certain cases, that those happen before they're closed and before people lose their children, because what you and Lillian are saying, and I respect the work that you do so much because it's so difficult, but at the same time, what we're being told, you know, in district isn't really matching with kind of where you guys are at, in that we're hearing things about, you know, parents who do have disabilities and there is no other neglect or abuse, and yet there are these comments that are being made about them that seem quite discriminatory. And it, you know, it has been reported that there's even been some efforts of intimidation to back people off who would support these families. And so it's really important to me that we get it right, because I think there are, just based on what I'm hearing, there is a need for more protections as it relates to parents with disabilities, because what is happening, I think, is not in practice as good as it could be as it relates to allowing these families to be able to keep their kids and for the community to support them. Because as we look at our foster care system, quite frankly, the last thing we need is to be adding kids to that, because it's not doing that well. And it's incredibly expensive beyond that. And so it seems like if we were able to, as a community, provide supportive services to families, as opposed to just saying, well, you know, we think they're, you know, they're retarded, or, because we've heard those words and people have actually used those words and there's evidence to that, and you know, that they're retarded, that they're lazy, or that whatever, and there seems to be some bias by some people. And so I think it would be better to support those parents in our community versus pull those kids out, put them in a very expensive foster care system that is you know, to say the least, challenged, to put it mildly. And so I just want to make sure that those things are happening. I'd be happy to talk with you, you know, offline afterwards or in the coming days. But it's really important to me, and I do think we need legislation. I appreciate the chair considering a committee bill for this.
And just before you respond, I think building onto that, I think that, again, can't talk about specific cases, but something comes to attention, and it's sometimes like the canary in the coal mine. What's happening out there, and what can you hear from those? The other piece around that competency is understanding the rights of adults with disabilities to be independent adults, and that the people that were their parents when they were children don't have the right to speak for them, that unless there is a guardianship, that an adult with an intellectual disability has the same rights as others. And one of the other things that I've wondered in this case, since there's such a discrepancy between what the people are on the ground are saying, what the central office says, and what the policy says, whether it would be an interesting candidate for a sensitive review committee, so that I think the challenge is outside of that structure. It's really impossible for people to have the real policy questions, and what looks really disturbing to us from the outside, there really could be a very significant other side to the story, but the way that it plays out is pretty deeply concerning.
Yeah.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and Senator Knope, thank you for your comments. I couldn't agree with you more. We know that we do more damage every time we take a child into foster care, and we don't take those decisions lightly. And I wish I could sit here and assure you today that there would never be a mistake on our watch. We do everything we can to assure that that doesn't happen. And in cases where there are questions or concerns, I appreciate the inquiry around that. I will not speak to the specific case here except to say that I have taken a deep look at that case. I would be very comfortable having conversation with you outside of this committee. It's always helpful when you're able to get a release of information from your constituents so that we can share information with you, because absent that, I'm not able to, and it's very hard to see the headlines like I saw. That's not the foundation of our agency. It's not the belief of our agency. It's not the core work of our agency. To tear families apart is the core work of our agency, is to assure the safety of children and to keep families together whenever we can safely. So I welcome the inquiries. I understand the frustration, and it's frustrating for me to sit here before you and not be able to speak specifically about actions the department has taken in specific circumstances.
And I want to be really clear, too, to anybody that's listening, you can't.
I can't.
And I think everybody here understands that you can't. And I think anytime any of us are working on this, these issues, we know that there's more information that we don't have that can skew the story. So I think it's really important that be really, really clear on the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Chair Gelser, you mentioned Sensitive Review Committee, and that is something that DHS can call that does involve legislators when there is a sensitive case, and I'd be happy to talk to Director Paxaresh about if he feels the need or the desire to call a sensitive review committee in this case.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for this panel before we move on? All right, thank you very much. And last up, we have Lisa Shellman from the Pearl Buck Center in Eugene.
Welcome. Thanks for making the trip out for us. My pleasure. It's so interesting to hear all of this, and these are all issues that I've been thinking about a lot. My name is Lisa Shellman. I am from the Pearl Buck Center Preschool. I'm the director there. It's been really interesting to hear all of this. I've just been there for a year. I've worked with at-risk kids and their families both at the Relief Nursery and at Head Start, and I had never come across a population that I felt was getting such a short shrift from the system. So this has become, in the year, my banner that I'm carrying is my concerns for these families and their children. I just have a couple of points I want to make, because we have, and you seem very interested in talking about the contracted services and sort of what that might look like. I thought I might try and, you know, race through and make sure that if you wanted to ask questions about that, that you would have a chance to do that, because there were many things that you were asking that I could speak to. So we have a contract for the in-home safety and reunification services, so that's not one of the SPRF ones. It's one of the smaller component. We work with families with cognitive limitations, which is a broader scope than talking about intellectual disability and developmental disability. It includes parents who might have traumatic brain injury, other types of brain injury. Sometimes they have mental health issues that have risen to the level that they are not functioning cognitively in the same way that other adults might. So it's a broader stroke for us. So one of the concerns that I have also is talking about, I think that probably about a third of our families actually fall into the category of having a disability, and yet the rest of them also need support and services. And I know that a lot of the research looks at cognitive limitation instead of just strictly at the people with the disabilities, because they need the supports also to parent successfully. Sometimes you're looking at the difference between calling it a disability. Somebody has an IQ of 70, somebody else has one of 72, and they then don't have a disability, and they're not getting the services to support them, but they still have the challenges as parents. So I think it's just important to remember when looking at systems that there are it's a broader scope, and that we could probably keep more kiddos out of foster care if we were able to work with that larger population. Another thing that I wanted to talk about is just the safety threats, sort of looking at the safety threats that are used to identify parents who are children who are at risk. some of those are not really using a good trauma-informed lens, and certainly some of the wording actually comes very close to some of the ways that we identify parents with cognitive limitations. I have one that I just wanted to read here. This is the first one that they have in the safety threats guide for the DHS caseworkers, and the first thing under that in terms of what that actually might look like is the parent or caregiver's physical and mental disability incapacitation renders the person unable and unavailable to provide basic care for the children. And that is so broad that I could easily see how somebody, a caseworker reading that, might think that that is something that describes what they're seeing. So I think that there's just some language in there, having read that, that is far too close to some of the ways that we describe and identify families with cognitive limitations. The other piece that I have is that in terms of lodging sort of complaints or concerns, it's very difficult for us to know who to talk to. We feel like our local DHS office, although they work with us very closely and we have a great relationship with them, sort of close ranks around any time that we bring up something. They'll tell us we don't know everything. They kind of poo-poo what we're saying, and that seems problematic. Systemically, it seems problematic. It seems like somebody should be hearing what the complaints are, not necessarily about the caseworker, because they are probably doing what they think they're supposed to. So looking at a systemic level, it seems to me that it would make a lot of sense for there to be a way for concerns and complaints to go someplace that isn't to the office where it's going to make a caseworker get their hand slapped. And what I'm hearing today, it makes it sound like that's something that would be really useful. I don't know how. That would probably be also be very expensive, because looking at our caseload, and we probably would have some level of complaint about roughly a third of the cases that we have.
And that complaint, is that a concern about basically what we talked about is cultural competency? Previously?
Cultural competency, overextending the length of time that families are in, that children are in care and not return to their families. We see that repeatedly, that there's so much caution about returning the children home even after the safety threats have been ameliorated. So, yeah.
And you said that you've been working with at-risk kids for a long time, so you've seen different populations. Do you see that reticence to return and that delay, is that different than for other populations that you've worked with in the past?
You know, that's my sense. I mean, having... This is the first time that I've worked directly with a contract, so it's a little bit different. I really am, we're much more on the inside working with the contract, but it certainly is my sense, and it's the sense of the people doing the direct work also, who've also worked with at-risk children for a long time, that the cases are elongated, and even after the safety risks are gone, or essentially gone, that there are they just go months and months and months of being careful before returning kids.
And then can you speak a little bit kind of outside of the child welfare sense about the long-term outcomes? Like, what happens to children that are raised by parents with disabilities in the long term? I met with Jan Aho a couple years ago from your center, who just right. talked about some outcomes for kids that they had served through that preschool program that was focused on those parents with cognitive limitations.
Well, sadly, I've only been there for a year, okay. So I haven't seen much of that. But, I mean, the research shows clearly that the parents who have come through our program, we have parents now who have children in the program who their parent was through. We have their parent came through the program. They love their parents. They stayed with their parents. So I think the outcomes are very bright if the parents get the right level of support. Anybody else?
Questions? All right. Thank you very, very much. We really appreciate it. All right. That's that for that panel. Anything else on this topic before we move on to the next one? Thank you to many committee members for requesting this topic today. It's always fun when everybody's kind of on the same page. All right. Next one to... Did she come back? Yes. Okay. The next one is Developmental Disability Services and Oregon's K-Plan, Past, Present, and Future. And a couple of quick disclaimers before we start this. One, we're really kind of focusing on the changes. There's been a lot of discussion about the increased costs
in the developmental disability system, especially on the support services side. That's why we don't have a lot of conversation today about residential services. And the other thing is, this is a conversation specifically about developmental disability services. Developmental disability services and APD services are really different, and the concerns and challenges that exist in the DD program do not speak at all to something that's worked really well in the APD system. And so for people that are out there watching from an APD perspective, this is not about you. has to do with the just this particular system and kind of some of the history of how we got to where we are, the good work that Director Tennedy is doing, trying to bring some cohesion to a complicated process that's happened over the last few years. So I talked with Director Tennedy last night, and we're going to go through the other people first and then have her come and do cleanup. So why don't we go ahead and bring up Bob Jundeff, Katie Rose, and Larry Deal. And Bob, if it's okay, I think we'll have them, maybe Katie, Larry, you. Does that work? Thank you.
In fact, that's a relief, Senator Gilson.
Hello, I think I get to go first. My name is Katie Rose, and I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Support Services Association. We are the association of the 14 support services brokerages that serve adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities in their own or family homes around Portland, Oregon. Thank you for inviting me here today, on a day when you're tackling so many important policy issues. I'm here to talk a little bit about our history with the K-Plan implementation, and I will say, my disclaimer is, I'm not here to talk about all of the thoughts, feelings, and experiences of stakeholders about the K-Plan implementation, speaking from the brokerage and in-home services perspective that we had. Specifically, I did serve as a brokerage director during the implementation in 2013, and I've served as the executive director of the association for a couple of years, working on many, many work groups and other meetings. Social workers are good at meetings, devoted to this sort of topic. So, I'd like to start with a kind of a before and after snapshot of the brokerage world. As you may not know, brokerages do provide case management services to adults living in their own homes, apartments, family homes, and without homes. We currently are not able to serve children by statute, and we also aren't able to work with people who are in like paid residential placements like foster care and group homes. So brokerages were created out of the Staley settlement back in 2000, and this was a result to eligible folks waiting many years for services. Oregon's DD system was really at a breaking point. We had kind of an all-or-nothing system where we had fairly generous services for people who were able to make it into the few funded slots that we had, and then everyone else was receiving no services while they were waiting for those slots. So brokerages were really designed to be a sum-for-all model, and we sought to distribute a capped amount of funding to everyone who was eligible for developmental disability services. We have provided community-based services since our inception. There were approximately 5,500, Bob might be able to speak more precisely to that number, people waiting for our services from the start, and Oregon has been a leader in deinstitutionalization and community service provision. We serve people where they want to be, and we don't take them out of their homes in order to offer them services. So in 2013, after about 12 years of rollout and growth as a program, brokerages were serving approximately 7,000 adults, and we had an annual benefit level that we were able to offer them of about $14,000 a year. The actual utilization was lower than that per person. So there were definitely still tricky problems that we were sorting out, and some people were certainly underserved at that funding level, but it was something that was a well-established program at that point. The K-Plan, when it was first introduced to us, I remember it well, it was February 2013 at one of our regular meetings. It was intended, as I understood it at the time, to make use of the Federal Affordable Care Act. probably heard of that one. And it was to get an enhanced federal match for the community-based care that we were already doing. It was described as a back-end billing process that we wouldn't really feel, but it became really evident to state staff and stakeholders as we continued moving forward in the next few months that that would not be true.
Can we clarify at this point, nobody currently in our DD program administration was here at this time? Correct.
Chair Gelser, yes, that's an excellent point. I will refer later to a few of the folks that we had worked with in leadership at that point to clarify things, but I think we've got pretty much a clean slate that we're working with at this point. So from the beginning, brokerages have endorsed the expanded supports and additional funding promised by the K-Plan. And we've also sounded notes of caution, advocating at every step for a thoughtful and careful implementation that really didn't compromise Oregon's shared core values. For brokerage services, the most profound changes that happened during this implementation were in the erosion of self-directed practice, the elimination of capped annual services in favor of a monthly hourly service allotment, and the return to a more medical service approach. So I'm going to briefly touch on each one of those. Self-direction I'm going to tackle first. Self-direction is the ability of a person receiving services to make decisions about how, when, and by whom they're served. It really asserts fundamentally that people are the experts in their own lives, and it puts the locus of control with them. The K-Plan really narrowed the number of options available to the people who were in brokerage services, and it put a more centralized focus and decision-making power at the state level for many things. So touching on the medical approach that I talked about, so the K-Plan is part of a federal medical model, and the language and approach that it takes really puts people with developmental disabilities back into a patient-caregiver relationship. And the more progressive approach that we had been founded on really looked at disability as one part of a whole human, while the medical model looks at disability as something to be fixed. So overnight, we stopped presuming competence in people, and they noticed. So finally, I just wanted to touch on annual versus monthly service allocations. So most of our needs change throughout the course of 12 months. And, you know, this happens with weather, school schedule changes, vacations, all the different things that happen. Our previous annual service allocations were really, it allowed people the flexibility to meet their needs as they changed throughout the year. And we found that moving to a monthly use it or lose it hours-based model really had a profound effect on people's ability to make the services work in their lives. So in June 2013, a small group of brokerage directors had met with Erin Kelly Seal, who was then the director of Department of Human Services, Tricia Baxter, who was then the chief operating officer for Aging and Disability Programs, and Patrice Botsford, who was then the director of the Oregon Office of Developmental Disability Services, to discuss our concerns related to the planned K-Plan changes. We outlined, among other things, our concerns about the long-term fiscal unsustainability of the K-Plan, and we were assured at that time that they were keeping an eye on costs.
And just to clarify, to put a point on that, what you had at that point were the advocates for disability services coming forward and saying this plan that you're offering has benefits that are too generous and we can't afford them in the long term.
So, Chair Gelser, that's a great point. We advocated a lot during the six-month period, and at the start of it, really in June 2013, we had not begun rolling out the new service allocations. And so we were really looking to the future and saying, this is going to take what is currently a cap structure, and it's going to open things up. And we, knowing our population in the way that we did, we're very concerned about what that would do for costs. So we hadn't had the direct experience at this point. So hopefully my description of the K-Plan implementation has already illuminated some of the drivers of rising costs. So we did take 7,000 folks in brokerage services and went from an annual limit of roughly $14,000 a year to an individualized service allocation that didn't have a set limit and can't by rule. There was, I think, an assumption that people who were living in their own or family homes, living in the community, had were doing that because they had fewer needs than folks in other types of services, but that really didn't bear out. So leads me to another cost driver. Some supports that were provided at no cost by friends, family, and community members were able to be paid under K-Plan services. So in many cases, this is how people were able to make the $14,000 stretch. And to be clear, brokerages have always paid family caregivers since our start, and they're often the best quality and least expensive option for folks. But federal K-Plan guidelines did take it a step further and allowed for payment of services that were provided free of charge up until that point.
And can I ask a clarification about that? Didn't it also require that? I know the guidance was complicated when it came out. I'm the parent of an adult with a developmental disability, and we sat in a planning meeting where the individualized assessment identified all these needs that we hadn't known that he had. We left the meeting feeling like we had a family member that was much more disabled than we'd ever realized before. And we said, well, we don't need all these hours because we do these things and we don't want anybody to come. And the concern was that was presented to us was that under the K-Plan, you could not supplant a paid support with a natural support, and then we wouldn't be able to indicate that it was done. And if we didn't take those hours, there might have to be a referral, like an abuse referral for neglect, because we weren't accepting the paid hours for those services, even though, you know, we had always been helping him brush his teeth, take a shower in the morning, monitoring him while we all sat around the dinner table to eat dinner. We didn't want an extra person there. And they fixed that later, but that was a concern for a couple of months.
Chair Gelser, I think you are clearly illustrating one of the main reasons that this was such a bumpy implementation for us. And I think that's because, I think at the federal level, they didn't have a lot of these practical questions outlined. And then at the local leadership level, the state didn't have those things figured out. And then with the director level, we didn't have it figured out. And you take that and try to articulate it to case managers and then families and people in services. And there were a lot of interpretations that were incorrect. People who were really trying to do their very best to follow guidelines that were unclear. Yeah. Finally, I want to touch on a cost driver that this committee has probably already heard a lot about, and that's the adult needs assessment. K-Plan regulations do require that you have a functional needs assessment tool in place, and ODDS had a very short implementation timeline for that, meaning that there was a flurry of activity in the spring months of 2013 to find an appropriate tool to assess needs and then allocate supports. So they pulled together stakeholders, including brokerage representatives, to look at existing national tools and state tools and consider assessment tools that were already in use across different parts of the system. They did sink several months to developing their own tool to try to save money and to make it a tool that was really tailored to their needs, but found that they didn't have enough time to norm and validate a new tool. And so ultimately they settled on the adult needs assessment, which is an adaptation of one of the tools that was already in use across the state. As you can imagine, they really did scramble to adapt that quickly and to build the algorithms into the question answers that would determine the allocation amount from a completed assessment, and then to train the folks in the field who were administering those assessments. So, and my understanding is that ODDS had negotiated a firm deadline with CMS indicating that the needs assessment needed to be ready and in use by November 2013.
And you first started talking about the K-Plan in February of 2013.
Chair Gelser, we did, yeah. That was the first that we heard about it. So it really didn't leave time to hone the tool or allow for proper testing. As we began to use the adult needs assessment, we did immediately find that the hourly allocations per month appeared to be quite generous. It wasn't an apples-to-apples comparison because the old method did make use of an annual dollar budget, and the new method was an allocation of hours that people could then decide to fill with various provider types at varying costs. But it was apparent to us from the start that most people were being allocated more support hours than they had before the K-Plan, and many people were making use of them. So we requested at that point and met with Aaron Kelly Seal and other DHS leadership a couple more times in late 2013 and early 2014 to express our alarm at the increase in plan allocations. I'm just going to read an excerpt from an informational flyer that we put together in early March 2014 to give you a flavor of that. While we have received assurances from the department that funding is readily available, we are still concerned that the ramifications of determining exponentially increasing funding levels via an untested assessment tool on a rush timeline. February 2013 plans in a metro brokerage averaged $11,000 a year. Today they exceed an average of $30,000 a year. Plans historically capped at $14,500 in brokerages. We now have plans over $160,000 a year. Our ask at that point, we request a thorough public fiscal analysis of the K-plan, the waiver, and this implementation. As a state, Oregon has entered into a social contract with people with IDD, and we must be sure that we make good on these contracts by not promising services 1 year and then, through reinterpretation, taking those services away the following year. Our history with this population demands nothing less. So we do stand by that statement that we made back in early 2014. However, and this is the nice part, I do get to share with you that there have been many bright spots in the K-plan coming to Oregon, and I just wanted to briefly touch on those as well, to be fair. People who were forced out of their homes and into 24-hour service options that they didn't choose are now able to stay home if they choose to, and they have the increased supports they need to age in place. We haven't talked about children's services since brokerages don't currently serve children, but the introduction of paid kids and home services has meant more stable entries into the adult system with children and families that aren't crash landing into paid services at 18.
Important and note, though, based on a budget note that we passed last session, that is going to be taken away for about a third of the families that are being served at home, because we are going to start considering parental income again, which will force more kids back into foster care before they turn 18.
Chair Gelser, I hope not, but yes. And then finally, people aren't forced to choose between meeting their basic daily needs and getting support to find employment. So thank you for the opportunity to speak on this topic. Oregon really can't afford to lose this history and repeat old mistakes. I will open myself up to questions, I guess, at the end of the panel discussion. And please also know that if you have any questions that weren't answered during this, I would be happy to take any of your phone calls. Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Larry Deal. I am the executive director for Independence Northwest, and we are we're a nonprofit brokerage in the Portland metro area. We actually serve Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties, and we serve about 500 folks or adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And I just have a few short thoughts, and I thought I was going to be at the end of the panel, and I thought a lot might be covered, so if you have questions along the way, please let me know. I've been part of the brokerage system since just about its inception, coming up on 17 years now. And I was 6 years into my career serving the disability community professionally when I moved to Oregon, and I connected with the brokerage system. And what I found here versus the other two states that I worked in was vastly different. I was floored by the inventiveness, the cohesiveness, and the engagement in the service delivery system. I have family members with disabilities, and I had never seen a system approach families and individuals in such a sensible and clear and inclusive way. What you had was a system that was actually driven by a community of architects, individuals and families and providers, community members who worked together to actually design a system with the person receiving the services at the center and in the driver's seat. And there was a clear set of expectation. People knew what their roles were within the system. We had a consistent language. There was clarity of purpose. Expectations for fiscal responsibility were defined, and they were actually baked into the model. And there was direction and oversight by those being served, all of our boards of directors, or at least 51% or more people with disabilities and their family members. So we're taking direction from those that receive the services. So brokerages were designed to bring something new into the community, and I think that's what we did. We moved 55 or so hundred people into brokerage services over 6 years, not overnight. And people moved into services on a thoughtful rollout schedule. We built community capacity and provider capacity and infrastructure and resources. You had to, because with 5,000 plus people coming into a system with some resources, we needed to have services to offer them. And so that's what we did over time. We analyzed what was happening and why it was happening and recalibrated things when they needed recalibrating. Things were not perfect. I think plenty of people would attest to that. I'm not hearkening back to the days of yore, and I don't believe that everything was perfect in those days. We had problems and we were working on them, but things were thoughtful, and I think that the people who were in the architect seats, for the most part, you know, they were continuing with a consistent vision, and you could see where things were going. When you were building steps, you knew where they were leading you. For 12 years, in-home services for people with disabilities did not present a major budgetary challenge in Oregon either, and it was something because the plans were capitated and we were using community resources to augment the needs of the people we served. We work closely with community programs, schools, and natural resources. And, you know, I believe that the investment was small and the payoff was significant at the time. When we fast forward to 2013 and we move into the K plan, in some ways, we were sort of forced into a ride that we didn't thumb for. And we were most certainly not engaged as fellow architects for the future of that system. Instead, there was an overlay. It was like, we'll just change these words. We'll just change these, you know, these pieces here. As Katie alluded to, we were told by former state leadership that this would be little more than a coding change on the back end of a data system. And as things began to unfurl, we saw that it was a little more complex than that. And so one of the more challenging parts of the experience has been watching the confusion that sometimes comes with this type of change implementation. Customers and families expressed concern regarding the way the initial functional assessment, when we first brought it on at like early 2014, what that was like. You were bringing something completely new into a system. You know, for 10 years we had been going in a conversational way, and suddenly now we're showing up at your door in a very clinical manner. Obviously, we need a functional needs assessment. That's an expectation of CMS, but the way that we went about it was jarring for families. It was confusing, as I think you expressed. So the shift to some of that medical language also was abrupt. For years, plans said, okay, I get community living supports, and now we're saying you get attendant care. And, well, I don't want an attendant. I want living supports to live in the community. You know, your mom is no longer receiving respite. She's receiving relief care. And language matters. It matters about the way that we think about ourselves. It matters about the way we think others think about us. And so over the last 4 years, I've done presentations on systems change and primers on Oregon's IDD services to thousands of Oregonians. I go to schools. I talk to teachers. I talk to students. I talk to parents. We do presentations at my organization or out in the community at provider organizations. And the one thing that keeps coming back, you know, to me from people is, What is it that we can expect long term? The back and forth has been very confusing for people, and I think something we talk a bit about. Katie was reading about it, knowing what our social contract is with the people that we serve, and being able to say, okay, this is what we're doing, this is what we can offer. The reason that's important is because people are building their lives around these services, and it may be planning for their children or for themselves. I'm not saying that funding will not ebb and flow. The people who receive services understand that. They've experienced that. This particular experience was a bit jarring, and the pendulum swung hard. And I think as we start to move forward on the next actions to take, approaching those changes thoughtfully and gingerly is essential, because constantly changing social contract, it can breed disillusionment and distrust with those that we serve, which is why we exist. I also think that it's important to understand that the people in our state are interested in being good custodians of public funds. When I talk to customers and families and educators and community members and other attendees of the forums, I show them charts of spending and sort of where things are and where they've been, and they understand it. They say, where do I fit within that? What role do I play there? And I think that's a really key piece, is if you explain to people where they fit in the puzzle and you share with them how the parts work and how we're all tethered together, they tend to understand it. I think we moved quickly into something, and now we're backing into this particular conversation. I think that there are groups of stakeholders that are meeting to talk about this very thing. I think state leadership is working on this right now. So I think that that sort of resetting of what it is that we're doing and why we're doing it, to help people understand it better, it engages them differently and helps them understand, you know, what it is that's happening and why, and lets them know they have a role in it. So I believe that in working to contextualize provides the services, where the funding comes from, what the purpose is, and what the limitations are, can go a long way as we're sort of slowly turning the ship. From here, I'm happy to take any questions you might have, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
I don't know where our panel is, but Sarah Montes Anderson, do you have any questions for these two?
Thank you.
I had one other question. Do you think it'd be fair to say that the increased cost based on that functional needs assessment, I know we talk a lot about the impact on the budget. Could we also say that that highlights the contribution that family support and friend support, unpaid, has supported our community prior to this? I mean, how it's paid for is different, but the supports were still happening.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I believe you're spot on. I think that one of the things, there was a lot of support happening in the shadows where people didn't realize that was going on. I think folks had some thought that if you have an intellectual or developmental disability and you live in the community, you must not have very high needs. And the truth is we have individuals with very, very significant needs, and that can affect family units. It affects communities. Some people are lucky and have a good support circle around them, and other people have very little. And I think understanding that we need to be able to offer a system that can support those who have things already in their lives, and they're rich in resources personally that have nothing to do with funding, and others who aren't rich in those things and require additional assistance to be able to maintain their independence in the community.
And the reason that I mention that is we wrestle with this and the cost and paid family caregivers. There is a really significant place for paying family caregivers, and many, 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 many families simply do not have the financial capacity to be able to provide that 24-hour support without another job and be able to feed their families and keep a home. So I just want to be careful as we have this conversation moving forward. It's not when caregivers need to be paid in order to support their family members at home. It's not a matter of not being committed, not loving their individuals. It's an economic reality around really what is a frayed. And I don't like using the word caregiving, but kind of support giving process. And I think that has been one of the benefits of the K-Plan for those families that couldn't provide that unpaid support and make it work with $13,000. Too many of those individuals weren't able to stay home with their families, and they had to give up a lot of choice and family connection to move into other service settings that weren't at home.
Yeah, and Chair Gelser, just a comment to that. I think one of the things that, and I sort of alluded to it or spelled it out earlier, I do think that one of the things, the development of provider infrastructure and making sure that there are options for people, because just being able to offer a certain set of funds but not having those additional, you know, developing the infrastructure around our provider base is essential long-term. This is a problem with seniors as well. Just making sure we've got the caregiving force out there that are available to people, especially as they age. Yeah.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, that would be Senator Mons Anderson.
It's the women. just saying.
We have staying power.
Well, that leads me to the topic of my remarks. My first introduction to this topic was in 1981 when I went on the board of an organization called the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Advocacy Center, which is now called Disability Rights Oregon. And when I went to that first board meeting, the topic of conversation at that meeting was how people were upset about Fairview Training Center and how people in the community who wanted to keep their kids at home, whose kids wanted to stay at home, couldn't, and by kids, I'm referring to both adults and youth, there was no resources for them. And people wanted to change. One of the board members sitting across the table from me was Barbara Roberts, who I noted really knew her facts. And so I thought maybe I could learn something. And what's happened is that somehow I've become a holder of institutional knowledge as people have come and people have gone through this in the service system over the years. So I've kind of watched the whole process. And one thing I think it's important for people to remember is that Oregon government, even even before we were a state, Oregon government offered supports to people who, families who had people with disabilities who needed help. It's a role of government, and has been for since we've been around. What we had when I went to that board meeting was primarily the largest institution of its kind in the country that attracted huge lawsuits. And what Oregon realized in the process of those huge lawsuits was that bringing that institution up to standard was incredibly expensive, and that the people who it served really didn't want that. Only a few wanted that level of service. Most people would have preferred to have services closer to home so that they could see their loved ones, they could hopefully have those loved ones in the family. And really it was the desire of people that brought about the change. As a lawyer, I like to think us lawyers, of course, call all the shots. But in fact, this was driven by the desire of the community that's being served. And out of the closure of that institution, which was a very progressive action by Oregon, we created something called a brokerage system. A brokerage system was created to meet the desires and needs of individuals and families. And it was a very unique system nationally, and it was built around the idea of self-direction, of helping people to determine the needs that...
I'm noticing the clock and two more items, so I love
your fast forward.
I'm asking you to fast forward to the cave.
Fast forward. I'm warming to my own voice. As we fast forward and the brokerage system was implemented, all of a sudden there started to be talk around this building about the K plan that came through the Affordable Care Act, and there was a sense that, gee, there's a higher match rate, so we should all jump on. People in the IDD system were not thrilled by the K plan, and the reason is that visionary people saw it as undermining self-direction and that had been developed in Oregon and that people were very happy with. And as the K plan came in, generally it was viewed that it worked really well over on the APD side, but in DD it was incredibly disruptive. And I'd say the DD system went through 2 years of havoc, maybe too strong a word, but incredible disruption. In the midst of that, all the staff were gone, and we have all new people in that system, and new leadership, and a delivery system that's still adjusting, and families that are still trying to adjust to a new world. Where we are now is we're still adjusting. We have a system, in my view, that is not responsive to the needs and desires of families and individuals with disabilities. It works really hard to be so because, in my view, the people who work in the system are incredible. They're very good. Your leadership right now is very good in trying to make this work. It is... Again, you heard that phrase earlier today, trying to take a round peg and stick it in a square hole in the DD system. It's providing a framework that doesn't fit with the desires and needs of the people that it's serving. So that's the struggle that we have today. The costs that we're dealing with now, I would submit, are structural in nature, because the way that we have the funding structured does not move the money to where it needs to be used most effectively and efficiently. So that's the struggle that we have, and hopefully as we move forward, we can adjust it to work for folks in a way that allows people to maximize their self-direction, to understand why it is that they're getting the services that they are and have an opportunity to interact with the structure so that they can get what they need.
Thank you. Questions, Senator Von Sanderson? Thank you all very much. Sorry to fast forward. That was a great fast forward of 20 years, like in just 1 second.
Thank you.
Thank you. Lilia Kennedy. As she's walking up, I personally think we're lucky to have the best DD director in the country who sits here and has to manage all these things.
Good morning, Chair Gelser and Senator Mona Sanderson. For the record, my name is Lilia Tennanty again. So this has been, thank you for having this panel and this discussion. I think that everything that's been said to this point, you're hearing a small microcosm of the world that we work in the DD system, myself, the leadership team of ODDS, and our partners in the community, CDPs, brokerages, and our providers. This is what we our challenge that we look at and deal with on a daily basis. There are a couple things I want to highlight, potentially even restate, and I think they're important just, you know, in the context of where the DD system is today and what we're faced with going forward. I appreciated your comments and what was reiterated here by the panel about the fact that for the APD system, the K plan made a lot of sense and is something that has benefited that system immensely. However, for the DD system, it fundamentally changed how we look at people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And that's not because there was any intent on anyone to do so. It was just how the federal regulation is written and how Oregon implemented the broad door that Oregon implemented to the K plan when the K plan was initially implemented. I want to say that I've been now in this role for 3 years, and by the time I came in, I was hired by Aaron Kelly Seal, and by the time I came in, I was given the leeway, a wide ability to say the K plan as it was implemented isn't working for the DD system and we need to look at changing it. So I want to be clear that I think a lot of lessons were learned from the point that was talked about earlier when the K plan was first discussed to the point that I walked in the door. And I think that was important because it was one of the things that I made clear coming in the door was this was something that I was going to be speaking to and that we needed to look at and change. And I feel in the time that I was here under the past DHS leadership, I was supported in doing so with legislators as well. I think the K plan implemented some really good things in the DD system. One of the things that's been referenced is that children with intellectual and developmental disabilities had had to wait for services until they became an adult or ultimately had to go into some kind of crisis situation before they were allowed to be served or were able to be served in a very small program. To your point, Senator Gelser, as a result of the issues that we're addressing with our budget and how our spending has increased considerably since implementation of the K plan, we are moving forward with the plan. I just want to clarify the language for people to make sure we're moving forward with a plan that would put a cap on our 1915C waiver. It doesn't remove parental income disregard. At this point, all it does is cap the number of kids who will be coming in. The discussion about what we do with parental income disregard can't come with the legislature, can't come in general until September 30th of 2019 when the maintenance of effort requirement in the Affordable Care Act expires. So I want to clarify the language around that for people who are listening and who may be concerned.
And can I just clarify from what you said yesterday? Anybody receiving services today will not lose them, but a new family coming into the system that is above either 138% or 200% of the federal poverty level may not be able to receive services, may go onto a wait list with no services, and that wait list could last for a long time.
Chair Gelser, that's correct. So we are submitting, our plan is to submit the waiver changes to CMS early next year, early 2018. We expect that there will be a lengthy discussion with them before approval. We expect that process to take at least 6 months. No changes in what's happening today with kids coming into the system will occur until CMS approves that waiver at that time. Then the changes.
The families that are considering applying for services should do that right away. You don't have to say that.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. So no changes will occur until the waiver is approved, when the waiver is approved with this expectation in it, nothing will happen at this point with all the children who are currently receiving services. So those are very good points to make. This is a change that will only impact those kids who potentially are waiting and are going to come into the system at that point. Kids who are in crisis who will need residential placement, there will be a set-aside capacity where we'll still be able to bring them in. The kids that it will impact in the future are those kids, again, not in the system now, whose parents make above the Medicaid financial eligibility requirements and are looking for in-home services. They would ultimately, under this plan, go on a waiting list.
And just to clarify, if that family is then in crisis and they're on the waiting list and that crisis is intense, the only choice will be for that child to go into foster care, or else they won't receive services.
Chair Gelser, yes. Unless they meet a higher eligibility criteria and are able to get into one of our children's in-home intensive service programs. So that is very complicated, and I'm sure we'll continue to have discussions with it throughout legislative days and even into next session, because it is something we're moving forward with, and it will take a lot of understanding about what the implications are going to be. The other good thing that's been raised that I'll reiterate is that we do have adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities who in the prior system oftentimes did have to go into residential placement in moments when maybe they didn't want to, where if the state had just been able to provide a little bit more support to them in their family home, they could have stayed in their family home. And so that's been a good thing as well. One thing that I want to speak to, too, is just the data about adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. The vast majority of adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and I think I'm going to say over 70% in nationally, and it's higher than that even in Oregon, this is we say live independently, but often what that means is actually they're not living in an apartment or a house by themselves. They're living with their families. So you've got a 30, 40-year-old individual with intellectual and developmental disability living with a 60, 70, 80-year-old often parent or family member. And that's just in the context of DD services and having a child with an intellectual and developmental disability. That's something you learn as you're moving along through the process with your child, is that, okay, my child is going to be living with me probably for a very long time for a number of reasons. So I think it's important to note that families do support children, and when we say children, we don't just mean under 18, we mean adult, well into adulthood as well. Some other points around the K plan is that this has been, I think, the budget drivers have probably been the biggest discussion point with legislators up to this point. We do expect, even without the change, or we are planning to make a change next year, but even without that, what we're seeing in terms of the increased caseload for children is in many ways the result of pent-up, what I will refer to as pent-up demand. Kids who have been living with their kids who have been living with their parents for many years, not being able to access services, realizing now that they can and coming through the front door. We did a study about 2 years ago. We looked at states that also had similar entitlement programs to services for intellectual and developmental disabilities. We compared our population with theirs. Ideally, or based on that study, we would expect that pent-up demand to make it all the way into our door by 2019. So we are taking a step sooner than that to address the cost curve that's occurring. But in general, we do expect to see, even without that, some leveling off at a later date, given the fact that all the pent-up demand, all the kids will be in the system, and we'll just be going forward from there. So I think those are the big points that I wanted to make. I think it's important, again, to reference, and I'm going to describe it in a way, someone who has had a career in this field, it's hard for me sometimes to explain things in a way that people who aren't as embedded in the system understand, but I'm going to share something that was shared with me that kind of helped me realize how we can talk about this. And I think the philosophical issues and what happened in the DD system as a result of moving to the K plan, even outside of the budget, are really honestly, from my perspective, the biggest challenges we're going to have to face in the future. We have to face the budget. There's no question about that, and we're taking steps to do it. But ultimately, at the end of the day, dealing with a budget problem is easier than dealing with a philosophical change in what people think about intellectual and developmental disabilities in the system. It took 10, to Bob June Deff's point, 20 years to get to the point we're at, you know, to get to the point with a Staley system, with a Staley settlement about how we view people with disabilities. It's going to take another 10 plus years to get back to where we want to be, which is instead of looking at a person with a disability and using a functional needs assessment to count up all the things that, and forgive me for saying this, I'm just describing this, count up all the things that are wrong with them, and then giving them more money, the more things that we find that are wrong with them. It's going to take time for us to get to a point where we get back to looking at the person and saying, what are your goals? What do you want to achieve? What are the supports you have around you right now that you're using? And then how do we use funding to shore that up and help you achieve the goals you want to achieve? And we're working on that every day. We have a large project that is looking at our whole order of operation and our planning process. It will also help us address budget, but ultimately the philosophical perspective and the values of the DD system, that's going to be the long-term work that's ahead of us right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you for all the work that you're doing. I know you get a lot of pressure from us, from the field, from everyone, and you really have led some significant changes in the system, and you're limited by budgets and federal rules, but the ability to communicate, engage stakeholders, and help people know what's going on, I think a lot of that credit goes to just your consistent effort when it's not always easy. So thank you.
Thank you.
Always been able to do that. All right, and before we leave that, I didn't mention this on the other ID, we're leaving IDDD, but a couple of us used the word retarded, which nobody should ever use that word. We used it because it was relevant to that conversation, but just wanted for the record, that is a very bad, terrible, horrible word. And
Yeah,
I used it too.
No, Chair Gelser, I agree, but that was, we were talking about what somebody had said.
Correct.
As it relates to a certain person.
Correct.
We weren't using that.
Correct.
In that way.
Correct.
So I guess we were repeating what somebody had said just to make sure people understood what is being said and that it isn't okay.
Correct. And so for those that are listening that maybe that context wasn't there, just wanted to be clear that that's why we've changed statutory language and everything else. Very bad word.
There were quotation marks around
that
word.
All right. Yeah. All right. Moving on. Thank you, IDD, for the last couple hours. So next we've got... we're going to receive a little bit of information about a bill that we need in February to address some holes in our abuse investigations as it relates to people with mental health and addiction. So we've got Justin Hopkins, Todd Noble, and Tanya Thompson. Please join us. And we're going to try to keep this panel to 15 minutes, so we've got time for our last panel, too.
We'll be brief.
Awesome. Thank you.
Okay, good morning. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Justin Hopkins. I'm the director of the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations. We're a shared service between the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. The reason that I'm here this morning is to talk to you about some gaps that we have in the existing laws that protect vulnerable individuals and some recent changes that we've made to our practices across the state in investigating abuse as a result of those gaps. So there are really three primary gaps that I wanted to address today. The first one is looking at the definition of the vulnerable population that's in Oregon Revised Statute 43735. The definition really talks about protecting individuals with mental illness who are either receiving facility-based care or are receiving services from a community mental health program. And a community mental health program has a very specific definition in statute. It's not everybody who's receiving publicly funded services. Community mental health programs provide very specific services, and with coordinated care organizations coming on board, the scope of services that are truly provided by just community mental health programs in accordance with that statute is really fairly limited. So we have a huge population out there that's really not protected by the existing abuse statute. The population for people with severe and persistent mental illness, people who may be highly vulnerable, if they're not receiving facility-based care or they're not receiving services from a community mental health program, they're really not protected under today's law. So we have stopped either conducting or coordinating investigations for individuals who may be mistreated or abused if they don't fall into the population that's in law. We've had recent appeals and lawsuits questioning our authority to investigate certain types of abuse in certain populations, and so we've had to make some changes as a result of those appeals and those lawsuits. I want to make sure that the committee knows that we are still ensuring protective services for those individuals. So we haven't made any changes to mandatory reporting, training, law rules, anything like that. If anything, we're trying to enhance the level of protective services that are being offered out there. The big change is that there's not a formal abuse investigation related to somebody who's not protected by that law. The second area that I wanted to talk about was the Oregon State Hospital. The Oregon State Hospital is currently not contemplated in the abuse statute. Again, the population is really limited to somebody receiving services from a residential treatment facility or a community mental health program. So the state hospital is not currently contemplated in there. We are working with the Oregon State Hospital to develop a memorandum of understanding and a policy and procedure for OWAPI to continue to investigate patient mistreatment. And really, the health authority and the Oregon State Hospital are using their authority as an employer to allow us to go in and conduct investigations into this patient mistreatment, these incidents that occur. We hope to have that policy done by the end of this month. Since I've been sitting here this morning, I saw the latest draft of that policy, so we're getting very close. Incidents will still be investigated. The difference there is that substantiated mistreatment or any kind of thing that's founded as it relates to that isn't going to be upheld by statutory authority. So how the information gets used down the road when somebody's seeking employment, those types of substantiations or founded mistreatment events won't be used in a criminal background check. So that's one implication of not having that information in the law or that protection in the law.
So to clarify, a person, you could do an investigation, you could protect that individual person by taking a protective services action, but when that individual maybe is terminated from that specific position because they had sex with the client or stole from that client, when they go and apply for a job elsewhere, there will be no way for that future employer to know that, even if they would then be working with a similar vulnerable population of people in the next employment setting.
Chair Gilster, that's correct. Both for the Oregon State Hospital example, as well as the community example, where we may be offering protective services to somebody but not doing that formal abuse investigation, the protections down the road won't be in place until we get the protection in the law. The third area that I wanted to talk about that applies both to the community side, the facility side, as well as the state hospital side in the future are discrepancies between the definitions that apply to different vulnerable populations. So today, a person with a developmental disability has more protection than somebody who has a mental illness. And there are some very specific definitions that don't apply to an individual with a mental illness. Abandonment, financial exploitation, verbal abuse. And then the big one that we see is neglect that doesn't actually result in harm. Those are things that don't apply to individuals living with a mental illness today, or protections that apply to them. They are protections that apply to somebody who's living with a developmental disability. So that's another area that could be addressed through a bill. And then the fourth area that isn't really a gap today, we haven't changed our practices related to this, but it is something that we talked to you about in the past session, was adding protections for people who are receiving facility-based alcohol and drug treatment. A highly vulnerable population, a lot of times they're mandated to be there by court, and they're really at the mercy of the people who are providing the services in a residential facility. And today there are no abuse protections in the law to protect them from abuse like there are for somebody who has a mental illness. I'd just like to thank Chair Gelser and the members of the committee for your commitment to protecting vulnerable populations. Happy to work with this committee in the upcoming legislative session to try to address these gaps, and be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and the members of the committee,
I'm Todd Noble. I am the health director. I'm the health administrator and mental health director for Linn County Mental Health. I thank you for the opportunity to come and testify. Justin here presented most of the information that I was going to talk about, but I will talk from a perspective of a provider that serves vulnerable populations, which is folks with mental illness. As Justin talked about, we do have some gaps in the log which negatively impact vulnerable populations, and it's our belief that these practices need to be, that these laws need to be changed to protect this population. As Justin talked about, the CCOs are not currently covered because the law is for monies that are being, or funds that are being directly coming from OHA or people that are in residential care. 85% of our funding is through our coordinated care organization. My concern as an employer is that we could run into a circumstance where we had an employee engage in some kind of abusive behavior, be it physical, financial, or sexual, and we could deal with it administratively. If the employee was licensed, the licensing board could deal with that as well. But the way the law is currently written, the vast majority of our adults that are being served in our mental health program are not protected, again, because they are not in residential care or directly funded by OHA. We could administratively terminate an employee that was involved in egregious behaviors, but there would be nothing to alert future employers that an abuse investigation has occurred and it has been screened out due to the current limitations of the law. Licensing boards can and do play an important role for behavioral health care, but not all people that work for our agencies are clinical or licensed. Theoretically, we could have a transportation worker, we could have a person providing peer-delivered services, or a clerical position, and they could engage in abusive behavior, and there would be no oversight by licensing boards. I know it's a complex issue, but we believe that a modification should be made so that consumers receiving behavioral health care, regardless of the location of services, and that public funding through the CCOs would be included in future language so that we could provide safeguards and protections for the most vulnerable folks in our community. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Senator Gelser and Vice Chair Senator Olson. I am actually on the agenda in case Mr. Noble was unable to make it here today. He had a prior appointment. And I know you're short on time, and I don't really have any much more to add to what Justin and Todd have already spoke to.
Well, it's always good to have a lot of people from Linn County.
Yes, and I don't think I introduced myself either. I'm Tanya Thompson from Linn County Mental Health, and I'm the program manager.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel?
Just one quick question, and this is for Justin. So, in terms of the lack of protections against negligence for people with mental illness, if it's not a question of negligence, neglect for that would create harm, what would be the alternative? Failure to thrive, or I wonder. If you could explain that difference.
Do my best. Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Dembro. The way the law is written right now, the set of definitions for neglect, there are three subparts to that definition. The first two apply to, all three of the definitions apply to somebody with a developmental disability. The first two talk about almost a threat of something happening, or the potential for something happening. So you leave somebody outside for 3 or 4 hours or whatever, and they're subjected to the elements. Unless something actually bad happened to that person, Part C doesn't cover that. So basically, I think what needs to happen is we need to make sure that the threat of something bad happening to an individual because of the action or inaction of an employee applies not only to the developmental disability population, but also somebody with a mental illness. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. So the difference is between actual harm and potential for
harm.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you all very much. Really appreciate it. All right, we're down to one more topic. So we have, and this is my fault for the way that it's labeled. This has to do with licensure. When somebody loses their license or gives up their license to provide care, what the safeguards are from that person or entity moving on with a new name or to a new system to provide care again. The reason here it says case study, here we have a place that was, and you've got both letters of revocation in your OLIS. In this case that people may touch on briefly, you had a kids' residential facility that had a license revoked for some relatively egregious behavior and practice. They were closed, but within a couple of months of that license being revoked by DHS, the health authority issued a license for the exact same people to offer a residential treatment program for adult males with drug and alcohol issues. And since then, once that came to the attention of OHA, they immediately revoked the license before they were able to admit anybody. But this happens in other places, which is why we have Ashley. So that's, anyway, please come on up. Dr. Richardson, Ashley, Wes Charlie, and Luann Mulink, maybe we can pull up an extra chair. And maybe we could start with Dr. Richardson, because I think in terms of this case, you're a person that got to be up close on this conversation, because you do everything.
Thank you, Senator Gelser and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Reginald Richardson. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Human Services. Because the agenda calls out a specific organization, I've been advised by DOJ to read the following statement. Okay. DHS has agreed to withdraw its notice of revocation, and Eastern Oregon Academy has agreed to relinquish its license to DHS. Eastern Oregon Academy denies allegations in the notice of revocation, and the parties have agreed that EOA's surrender of its license is voluntary and without admission or wrongdoing on the part of EOA. The parties agree that DHS has a reasonable and good faith basis to investigate the allegations set forth in the notice of revocation. You have copies of the notice of revocation. That is a public document, but that is the agreement that we entered into when they surrendered their license. Specifically, to address the purpose of part of what I'm going to talk about, it is indeed possible for an entity to have regulatory action taken against them with the children's section of DHS, and then sort of rebrand, come back as another entity with a new name. However, our current rules indicate that any provider that's interested in becoming licensed as a child caring agency, they must demonstrate their suitability. And so what we've used in the past, this part of the rule that allows us to determine whether or not a provider has had past experiences with regulatory actions and exactly what those regulatory actions are. And we have denied the application of providers most recently where there's been regulatory actions taken against them. They disclose it to us, and then we decide that they are not suitable to be a child caring agency. So we have done it by our rules, not necessarily because of statute. So I'm happy to take any questions that the committee may have.
Can I ask, and please, maybe you can't answer the question because of DOJ, and that surrender of license in that agreement, because I think that happens there in many cases, that there's the process is short-circuited, the license is voluntarily surrendered. Was there an agreement in that for a period of time under which they wouldn't be licensed by DHS?
Yes.
And that was, are you allowed to say that?
Or I am. That's information that's in the agreement. I just don't know off the top of my head how long that is, but I can get that information.
But I think the point being in that negotiation where the agency is negotiating public safety, certainly when I read that, the assumption was, okay, these people won't be providing paid services to vulnerable Oregonians for this this period of time. I think it was just a surprise that under that agreement that there's kind of a loophole in that you could then jump to another agency and...
Senator Gelser, yes, that's a gap in our communications. One of the things that we've done when this was brought to our attention is that we have monthly safety meetings within DHS for all five of our programs. We've invited the Oregon Health Authority to participate in those monthly meetings so that at least we have a way in which we can communicate the providers that we have concerns about, that they can share what their concerns are, and they're at least more aware of what regulatory actions we might be taking.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. My name is Wes Charlie. I am the Director of Quality and Compliance for the Health Systems Division of Oregon Health Authority. We're the group that's responsible for the licensing that we're talking about here. So what I was hoping to do is just kind of take you through a high level of the events of kind of how the license moved through, what we found during our investigation once the complaint was raised, and then kind of what our resolution and path forward is. So in June of this year, Oregon Health Authority licensed the Grant James Center in Hines, Oregon. Shortly following that in July, the Oregon Health Authority External Relations Office notified us that there was a complaint about this license, specifically around the fact that the owner and chief executive officer had recently operated a facility that had its license revoked. And so at that point, OHA immediately began investigation. We did an immediate site review to review what was going on in the facility, so we had a good understanding of that. And upon conclusion of the investigation, what we found was there were some gaps. So in this instance, there wasn't a revocation, and so it wasn't something that popped up immediately to us while we were doing the licensing. There were some gaps in our application and some gaps in communication, which was mentioned there. So we took a few steps. So I think immediately we updated the application to ask the question about, have you had a previous disciplinary action on a license in Oregon or another like license in another state? So that was done nearly immediately. Again, the communication piece was set up with DHS around a monthly meeting. We also added in our procedure that before licensing any organization, we actually have in our procedure now where we're reaching out to DHS to ask the question, you know, if there's anything outstanding before we actually issue the license. And then in addition, there's a couple of recommended changes that we're making to the rule, which we think we can cover all of these gaps in rule based on what we're looking at. So there's two areas really around the required application information. That's putting in rule that it's required on the application, that they're providing written background information pertaining to any current or previous licensure by any state agency, including those licenses or certificates granted to a business or person affiliated with the business, which would include licenses, certificates, things of that nature.
Would that be beyond, because I know in this one there were also issues with the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. Would that include those as well?
Yeah, so that issue specifically is part of the reason why we wanted, so there was language in our rule today, but it didn't necessarily cover things outside of DHS and OHA, and so that's part of what we're recommending as a change, is to broaden that language a little bit to make it a little bit easier for us to identify that. So any document showing final disposition of any suspension, denial, or revocation, or any other disciplinary actions, or any current or previous disciplinary actions, documentation of any sustained, substantiated allegations or abuse, or neglect, to the applicant or anyone employed by the applicant or contracted with the applicant. So we kind of broaden the language there to go away from just those who work with it, also to the people that are applying, in this case, the owner, chief operating officer. And then lastly, so that was really around the application, and then really around the rules for denial, just a simple language change to expand it to include all state licenses, Oregon Department of Human Services, Oregon Health Authority, any state agency, and then any similar state agency outside of Oregon. So we really broaden the language on that a little bit to give us a little bit more ability to act once we identify the problem.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Luann Muehlink, and I'm the licensing and certification manager for for the Health Systems Division of the Oregon Health Authority. I don't have anything to add, but I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
And then maybe we could add Ashley in and then do questions.
Good morning, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. I'm Ashley Carson Cottingham, the Aging and People with Disabilities Director at the Department of Human Services. So are there times in the Aging and People with Disabilities system where we have a provider that's not in substantial compliance with our rules and laws? Sometimes a provider chooses to voluntarily give up a license. Sometimes we do an immediate suspension. Sometimes we revoke. Sometimes we do a non-renewal of their license at their annual relicensure, every other year licensure. But most frequently, the provider works with us to come back into substantial compliance and stays in business. Sometimes the provider reappears later to reapply either as the same type of provider or one of the other types of providers. We have approximately 1,600 adult foster homes licensed in the state, over 500 assisted living residential care facilities, and some of those have the memory care endorsement on top of that, and then 137 nursing facilities. So we have a significant number of facilities in the state that we're responsible for as far as licensure. It is difficult to track across the different systems and the different types of licenses. We will have some entity attempt to license with, again, a different program in DHS than they were formerly licensed, or they can go over to the Oregon Health Authority and attempt to be licensed, because the Oregon Health Authority and our ODDS program within DHS also have adult foster homes. We also, in the adult foster home world, you can attempt to be licensed in different counties. The licensing happens at the local level, and until very recently, we didn't have a way to track across counties if someone had a bad history of performance on their license in one county, they could go apply in a different county, and we weren't tracking that very well. Luckily, we now have a system in place that allows us to look at that data statewide. We've had owners restructure under a new legal entity for some of the larger facilities and even some of the smaller foster homes. We've also had people give up their license, have a spouse be relicensed, or a family member, maybe with a different last name. And sometimes they sell businesses to different individuals within families. And then I think one of the other examples that we've come across is where we had someone denied due to untruthfulness on their background check, but in our nursing facility and community-based care rules, you only have to disclose if you have a 10% ownership interest and 5% ownership interest if you want to become certified to do Medicaid. And we've become aware that the entity might be trying to drop that percent down below the 5%, get other investors, and then become recertified or relicensed. So what are we doing about it? First, again, I want to be clear that I don't think we have the perfect system yet for tracking providers across all of the different systems. We have a lot of work to do, and my suggestion would be that we all collectively get around the table and try to iron out the issues, find more gaps, and close those gaps. As I mentioned, we have Aspen now in place, which started out as a nursing facility compliance database, and Oregon uses it now for community-based care and our adult foster homes. We utilize the OIG exclusions list. That's a federally kept list. But the problem with that is that there are oftentimes huge delays in the information being posted on the OIG exclusions list. So we have one example where we know that a crime was committed by a provider, and we just checked yesterday, and it's still not on the OIG exclusions list a year later. So that can be really frustrating. When we reach a settlement agreement with a provider, we often have DOJ draft the agreement to exclude the provider from attempting to reapply in a variety of setting types. What we're uncertain about right now is our authority to have that prohibition in place in perpetuity. So oftentimes it's a set number of years, but I think recently we've attempted to say you can never reapply, and I think there are potentially constitutional issues around doing that. We've also implemented a process where we have abuse allegations come in more real time from the abuse investigators to our licensing division, and then also simultaneously put into a spreadsheet that's shared with the background check unit. So we closed a gap where there was lag time in when we've substantiated abuse and when the background check unit knew that it was substantiated abuse. So that helps with the denial of the background check part of a license in more real time. In our review, DHS APD does have broad authority to restrict someone across our adult foster home system because at one point they were not in substantial compliance with the rules. It doesn't even have to rise to the level of a revocation or a suspension or the more serious. Even if they were not in substantial compliance with rules, we do have that ability to deny an application. That same authority doesn't apply in our initial review of the statute to the residential care facilities or the long-term care facilities, which are our nursing homes in Oregon law. So that could be something we look at to see if that would help. Also, in our foster home rules, we do have the ability to deny someone based on association with a person whose license for foster home or residential care facility was denied, suspended, revoked, or refused to be renewed. Association means that the person applying resided with the former licensee, employed the former licensee, employed the person, received financial backing. So there's all kinds of reason someone is associated, and that is in our current rule. Again, someone can challenge this, though, in an administrative law hearing, and there are likely constitutional issues that would be raised, and how long can that sort of prohibition be in place without some sort of weighing test of whether the threat or issue has been remedied. Let's see. In our in-home program, that's the last piece that I'll talk about, we have developed an across-system provider status tracking tool. And if for the first phase of the rollout, APD, home care workers, Office of Developmental Disability Services, personal support workers, and OHA Health Systems Division, personal support workers, and child care providers are included. So information about formal terminations, inactivations, and suspensions are put into that database that's shared, and our provider enrollment unit checks that when people are attempting to be either initially certified as one of those Medicaid providers or recertified. But that could be a mechanism that we use then to include other provider types, or we explore whether it would have the capacity to do that. As you can see, this is a really complicated issue with a lot of moving parts. There might be a potential need for statutory modification. I think we can look closely at our rules and maybe make some updates and changes to close those gaps. And then we can work better across, I think, our agency and both agencies together to develop that partnership. We look forward to working with the committee and our stakeholders, our provider partners and DOJ to make sure we have the right authority in place to protect consumers and to have a high quality service delivery system. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
Thank you. This is important work.
And thank you. It's as usual, it's really remarkable how quickly you are able to make things happen. I mean, for a complaint that comes in July to have already changed applications and questions and rule, that's incredibly responsive, and thank you for doing that, and the department has done the same. So thank you all so much for making time to come, and again, my apologies for a very confusing header. I blame developing agendas while on vacation for poor subject headings. All right. The last section is the discussion on future legislative concepts. Each senator gets one bill, as opposed to the House members. They each get two, and our committee gets three.
So far what I'm aware of that we have in this committee, and we can all talk about this later, but just to put out on the record what we're thinking about, there is the topic we had earlier about people with parenting and people with disabilities, kind of holding one in case there's a need on this topic around the licensing. There's a question that may or may not need a bill from adoption agencies that may have inadvertently been caught up in some regulation that doesn't apply to them and that's causing difficulty for them. I committed my personal bill to the abuse definition issue that we heard from Justin. I don't know if there are other committee bill candidates that you all had that were missing. Right, anything else for the good of the order before we go? I'd like to point out to Senator Olson that we were not here for 9 hours.
You're right.
Neither was I.
Thank you to everybody that came. I know there was a lot of preparation for a lot of really good panels. And with that, we are adjourned. A lot of really good panels.